Committee, and we are very, very happy to be here in Duluth on a cold day. But as the mayor told me, it's a dry cold, and I think we can all handle that. But it's been wonderful being here, and we appreciate the turnout and so many great people here. Of course, whenever I'm in Duluth, I remember my dear, dear friend, former County Commissioner Steve O'Neill, who many of you know, my mentor and friend, and I always think of him in these moments, and particularly in his hometown here in Duluth, or adopted hometown in Duluth. So what we're going to do is go around the table here and have the members and staff of our wonderful committee introduce themselves, and then we will have some comments from some of our local elected officials here, and then we'll hear Representative Murphy's bill about NLX, and we'll have some public testimony. I'm very pleased that our committee is here in Duluth. We have had a series of field hearings around the state, but Duluth is such a critical transportation hub, not only for this part of the state, but really for the entire state. You have like all just about every mode that we deal with and have oversight in this committee is here. There's a port, there's railway, there's airport, you have transit issues, you have road and bridge issues. Really every aspect of transportation is important to this city and to this entire region. So we have many issues to discuss here, and we welcome the opportunity to engage with Northeast Minnesota this afternoon. So why don't we start here to my left, and then we'll work our way around, and then Representative Torkelson, as has been our tradition, our ranking member will conclude and have some welcoming comments of his own. So why don't we start here?
I'm Jennifer Nelson, DFL Research.
I'm Dan Wolgemut. I represent District 14B, which is the St. Cloud area. Glad to be here.
Erin Cagle, I represent Blaine Coon Rapids Spring Lake Park, 37A, born in Duluth, and did my undergrad and graduate here at UMD as well.
Good afternoon. I'm Sandra Mason. I represent District 51A, which is most of Western Eagan and all of Northern Burnsville. And again, it's a pleasure to be here.
And I'm Representative Michael Nelson. I'm from Brooklyn Park. I represent the southern half of Brooklyn Park, House District 40A, and I'm probably the only person that's sitting up here today that's ever ridden on the old Duluth train line up here. We came up here for a labor rally one time and rode it back.
Good afternoon. I'm Lindy Somick, Committee Legislative Assistant for Transportation.
Hello, everyone. My name is John Howe. I'm the committee administrator, and I'm the person, if you'd like to testify, raise your hand. I'll come out and get your information so we can hear from you today.
I'm Matt Burris with Minnesota House Research Department.
Joe Marble, House GOP Research.
Nolan West, I represent Blaine in the legislature.
John Heinrich, representing the cities of Anoka and Ramsey, District 35A.
And I'm Linda Runbeck, representing District 38A, which is Lionel Lakes, Hugo, Centerville, Circle Pines, a bit of Blaine, and Lexington.
Hello, it's nice to be here in Duluth. John Petersburg, I represent down southern Minnesota, Wauton Wasega, District 24A.
Good afternoon, everyone. Paul Torkelson, Republican lead on the committee. I represent District 16B, Brown, Redwood, and some of Renville County. Happy to be here in Duluth. I've been here many times, and it's a beautiful city with lots of tremendous assets. I have to note that I think the chair left this roll of duct tape right by my seat. And for those of you that know something about legislative history, you know that duct tape has been used inappropriately at times. The former Speaker of the House here knows all about this, so I'm going to try to make sure that none of this ends up on anyone's mouth today. With that, Glad to be here and look forward to learning more about the issues here in beautiful Duluth.
Well, thank you very much, members. And our first speaker or testifier really is going to offer some welcoming comments. I have had a great partnership with the mayor of Duluth. Mayor Larson has been great to work with and is a wonderful mayor, and I know cares deeply about the many transportation issues here in town. And we would like to call her up and make some opening comments for the committee. Yeah, let's give her a round of applause.
Push, there we go. Thank you, Chair. Thank you so much to the members of this committee for being here. My name is Emily Larson. I welcome you warmly on this cold day to the best city in greatest Minnesota, or our favorite city, city of Duluth. And I often like to remind people that we think of ourselves as a big part of greatest Minnesota. And I know that as you are tasked to go through your work this session and start putting together the projects that are important to you, we really do value how we connect for all of you in the Twin Cities metro area that we are a regional center. My first experience with the city of Duluth was on the train. 40 years ago, I had my first experience getting off the train from St. Paul, took a train up here to the city of Duluth. And I grew up in St. Paul right by the railroad tracks. We would go and watch, we would put pennies and quarters on the tracks. Well, pennies, quarters were too much money then. And watch the trains flatten them out. My brother and sister and I, and one day my mom came to collect us, and a passenger train went by. And she said, that one right there, goes to Duluth. And one day we're going to take you on that train. And my mom and my dad did. I was 5 or 6 years old. It was the late 1970s. It was not a economically robust and hopeful time in this community, but we got off that train in the beautiful downtown depot, and we carried our suitcases through the streets of downtown to the Holiday Inn, and we had the most memorable, the only family vacation, actually, I had as a child. But we ate ice cream and saw the lake and went swimming and did all sorts of things. And it was then that I really felt that deep connection to Duluth. So chose Duluth as my home for college and then settled in. But the story of how we move around is one that is really important. And so I thank you for your work. And while my first experience here was the train, others have different entry points. I do just want to share as a brief bit of background that, and thank you for your support of the legislature to ratify our sales tax, which was a priority of ours for the city of Duluth. We put on referendum a 0.5% sales tax to go fully to repair our roads in the city of Duluth. And when we put that on referendum, it passed with 77% of the vote. It's because we know that our residents here really want reliable transportation citywide that is fair and equitable. So I thank you for that. We have strong partners like St. Louis County and MnDOT who do substantial work. And I want you to know that we also take transportation really seriously within the city of Duluth. We have a transportation planner, which is new for us. The city has never had that. We really look seriously at how transportation impacts economic development and housing and equity. How are we connecting people fairly across our cities in equitable ways that allow them to get around and have a safe and vibrant, good life? So I want to welcome you to the City on the Lake, 86,000 residents, 35,000 daily commuters, and 6.7 million tourists. We are happy to have you here for the day. We hope we get you back on another trip, and happy to talk in greater detail at your convenience, Chair, on any issues related to transportation.
Thank you so much, Mayor. And if we have anyone from the committee that has a brief question or comment at this time, we can proceed with that. Well, thank you again. Thank you so much for hosting us and for all your wonderful work. Next, we will have an update from MnDOT about some of the issues that impact this part of the state, and we're so happy and pleased that the commissioner has made it up here to share with us and with the Duluth residents and others that are here today her agency's work in this region and some of their priorities and challenges in this part of the state. So with that, I'd like to welcome Commissioner Margaret Anderson Kelleher. And I think there is a presentation as well that yes. MnDOT has. Members, you have a handout, which I'd like to call your attention to, with the MnDOT logo. Welcome, Commissioner. Wonderful to see you.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you so much, and thank you to the community of Duluth and the surrounding area for welcoming all of us here today. It's always good when we can come north and be visiting, especially, I think, at a time when there's so much possibility here for the investments that are being made in the Duluth area. So I want to bring you greetings. Next to me is Dwayne Hill, who is our very, very capable district engineer. Dwayne has been leading these projects. He's going to take you through a number of the projects that we are either engaged in right now or planning for the Duluth area. But I want to mention them briefly to you, a couple of things in particular. Beyond the rail connection, we are also planning a major investment with the community in the interchange known as Twin Ports Interchange, as well as finishing the Highway 23 connections. And we are in the process of planning a replacement or significant upgrade to the Blatnick Bridge, which we've talked about a little bit before in your committee, Mr. Chair, about what that looks like. We share that project. We'll share that project with Wisconsin. And so to that end, our goals are increasing the mobility for the people of Duluth and the economic development around Duluth and the Port of Duluth, making sure that mobility and safety are top of the list, as well as really trying to work with community members and the broader public and Minnesotans on these issues of climate change and climate adaptation. And Duluth knows this better than many other places in the state due to the both severity of storm events, and of course no further do we look than most recently with the time frame that the snow came in here a couple weeks ago and how severe it was. But rain has often been an issue, and so one of the things Dwayne will speak to is the work that's being done to try to build for a more resilient infrastructure, to be able to stand up to what we see as the demands. The other part of that, of course, is work to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions through both the governor's initiatives on decarbonization of the transportation sector, including the types of vehicles we're driving, the electric charging infrastructure that's being worked on. But then also, I would say, the other part of that is making sure there are good options for Minnesotans. And, of course, the train, Northern Lights Express, will help with that to give another option. Trains are actually one of the options that give us a more low-carbon transportation option across the state. And I do also want to point out that the Duluth Transit Authority is really held out as has a very good and robust system, and we want to make sure that that is also a good option for people in Duluth to continue to use. So, Mr. Chair, I will be here with my colleagues. I think Dwayne is going to lead off, and then Frank Letterly from the rail office is also here to give the presentation.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
All right. My name is Dwayne Hill. I'm the MnDOT district engineer. Good afternoon, and thank you for allowing me to speak with your committee. So I'm going to talk about five different topics today. So I want to give you an update on our Twin Ports Interchange project. I want to let you know a little bit about replacement needs for the Blatnick Bridge. I want to let you know about the Cross Range Expressway I'll talk about kind of some of the weather resiliency issues that we've had in northeastern Minnesota. And then lastly, I'll kind of circle back to our Mission Creek Bridge replacement project, which relates to weather resiliency. So our Twin Ports Interchange project, it is mainly focused on replacing the interchange at I-35, I-535, and Highway 53. Locally, the interchange is known as the Can of Worms. And we started this project by pursuing some federal grants, and we didn't think the Congress would be very excited about funding a project called the Can of Worms, so we looked for a new name for this project. So the focus of the project is, first of all, to improve the safety of the interchange. On I-35, we have two left exits that cause a lot of weaving and a lot of crashes. And then we also have the ramps merge from two ramps merge into one lane at several locations in the interchange. And it's difficult to see the oncoming cars. And unless you're a local, you don't know you're supposed to yield. And we have a lot of crashes caused by those short merging areas. So we call them blind merges. So we have about the fourth highest crash rate of any interchange in the state in this location. And we want to try to make improvements to the interchange to address that crash rate. We also know that all of the infrastructure in this interchange is approaching the end of its life. There's 27 bridges in the interchange. And MnDOT's kind of typical way of programming projects might have been to look at those bridges one at a time as they became into poor condition. But you have to look at a location like this as a comprehensive set of projects and try to find funding to do them all at once. So that's what we did with this project. And then probably lastly, and the driver for pushing this project ahead is to improve freight mobility. So this is the first mile to and from the Duluth Superior Port Authority's property, which is a center for a lot of trucking activity, and particularly a center for a lot of oversized, overweight trucking. Their property holds the only lift facilities in the whole harbor to take big project cargo off of ships and put them onto either rail or trucks, and to leave this part of the leave the end of the Great Lakes towards wherever their destination may be. And our infrastructure doesn't have the carrying capacity to allow those loads to get directly onto I-35 or 535 and then I-35. So we're forced to detour all of those heavy loads around the interchange on local streets. It adds quite a significant amount of time to those loads. It's very inefficient. So improving that first mile really does a lot for the efficiency and marketability of the Port of Duluth. So this project right now has been in the news. Our project budget, total project cost budget, was set at $343 million, and it's funded in our current STIP. We're doing construction manager, general contractor contracting. We have plans that are more than 60% complete, and we've gone through two pricing milestones with our contractor. And we know the estimates for the project are coming in quite a bit over our budget, about $100 million. So as we developed this project, we've worked with our communities and our stakeholders to really engage with them to figure out what the right components of the project should be. And as we've developed this, we realize that we have to basically manage our budget to within what we have, and there's two components of the project that we've proposed that are not going to be able to be built with the funding that we have. So those are the interchange at Garfield Avenue and a bridge on Highway 53 going from the interchange up Piedmont Avenue from Superior Street to 19th Avenue West. And the two components of that project that we can't fund right now are about $100 million in value.
Can I just go ahead.
So, Mr. Chair, one thing I want to say is Dwayne is a great driver, and he took me on a tour of the interchange and the Blatnik Bridge that would probably give most people pause. I ask him when he could stop, and we will figure it out. But part of figuring this project out with where we are in the contractor estimate is that we've made a decision at MnDOT to design the whole project. And by designing the whole project and being able to phase the project, that is the commitment to Duluth and the community and to the system, that we will have the portions designed in such a way that should more funding become available, we can add those portions into the Twin Ports interchange back in. If we stop designing those portions, it would be make it very difficult later on and much more expensive at a later date to come back in and add Garfield Avenue back in and the Piedmont portion of the project back in.
Representative Torkelson has a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Hill. Could you describe a little bit the bidding process or the type of contract that's involved with this particular project?
Okay. So this project is construction manager, general contractor. So it's an alternative delivery method. So we have two different alternative delivery methods we use, design build and CMGC. We have legislative approval to do 10 CMGC projects. Basically, the CMGC project allows us to, or process allows us to select the contractor through a technical selection, like we hire a consultant. And they work with us through the design development to influence some decisions with the design, the environmental. So on this project, one of the major factors the contractor's been able to do is help us identify needs for construction staging areas, dealing with contaminated properties, and even traffic staging during their work. Their technical contract requires them to build a project schedule and an estimate based on what they anticipate needs to be done. So at 30%, 60%, and 90% completion of the plans, we have a pricing milestone where the contractor submits their estimate, and we compare their estimate to two independent estimators that MnDOT hires that work simultaneously on the developing cost estimates for the plans. At those pricing milestones, we have a process that's called reconciliation, where we look at where our independent estimators are different from the contractors, and we try to reconcile the differences, try to understand the differences, and that's our opportunity to drive the contractor's price downward. At the end, what we're trying to do is establish a fair and reasonable price with the contractor. So when they submit their final bid, we have the ability to determine whether that price is fair and reasonable based on our independent estimators. If it's not, we can put the project out for low bid. It's being developed in a way that it can be put out for low bid. But if we determine that it's fair and reasonable, we issue the contract. What we've learned with this is that this process provides innovation through the design process that our consultants and our internal designers can't bring to the table because they're not contractors. It brings forward more price certainty because we're all at the table as we develop this. There's less unknowns. We're able to investigate the unknowns as we go, and we're able to adequately determine who should take on risk with the project. And then lastly, it provides us schedule certainty, which is really, in a project like this, where you're going to interrupt traffic to and from the two downtowns between Duluth and Superior for 3 years, it's really important to be able to understand how you're going to affect the commuter traffic and the duration of that. So we're able to have price and schedule certainty through this process.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Hill, for that very worthy explanation of the CGMC, or CMGC, I should say. What kind of sticks out like a sore thumb here is the difference between the budget and the cost of the project. Can you just give us a little bit of an explanation as how we got there?
Well, so our initial cost estimates for this project were developed basically by looking at what infrastructure needed to be replaced and determining unit prices for based on square feet of pavement, square feet of low complexity bridges, square feet of difficult complexity bridges, and then kind of adding on top of that kind of some all the multipliers that we would add to those square foot costs to kind of reflect an early estimate for or a scoping estimate for a project. Additionally, we do a Monte Carlo type of a risk analysis where we develop a risk register for the project that identifies risks like dealing with railroad, dealing with contaminated property, traffic staging, dealing with local impacts that we can't initially foresee with the initial scope of the project. As we got into the, and so the Monte Carlo process basically identifies the impact, if that risk is realized, in a cost, and the probability of it occurring. And maybe the, in a short description, maybe the best way to describe it is almost every risk we identified came true as we developed the project, and all of our costs were at least what we initially identified, which caused us to learn that the cost of the project is quite a bit more, 25% more than we initially anticipated.
Thank you.
Representative Petersburg, and I think after Representative Petersburg's question, I think we should move on to the discussion of the Blatnik Bridge and some of the other issues. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is just quick. It sounds like the program that you use for bidding and engineering is much different than the design-build program, which in this case sounds like you're doing the cooperative designing prior to the bid. Was there a reason for choosing that model versus one versus the other?
So we go through a delivery selection process before we make a determination whether we're going to use bid-build, design-build, or CMGC for complex projects. And with this project, we understood that there were a lot of risks in developing the project and a lot of unknowns. The CMGC process allows the owner, the designer, and the contractor to collaborate. So the owner's involved, where if we would have gone, say, bid build, we wouldn't have had the contractor's input. If we'd have gone design build, we wouldn't have been able to provide input as we understood more the complexity of the project. So this allows us, MnDOT as an owner, to have input into the design details and the staging details.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. And if you could proceed, Mr. Hill, with the rest of your PowerPoint. And then following the PowerPoint, the last piece, just so people know where we're headed here, there'll be a little bit of MnDOT's perspective on the NLX, and then we'll go right into a hearing on Representative Murphy's bill. So proceed.
All right. So Blatnik Bridge, and this is informational for you. So there's two major bridges that cross the harbor in Duluth, the Blatnik Bridge and the Bong Bridge. The Blatnik Bridge is about a little over 7,900 feet long. It's the second longest bridge in Minnesota. It crosses two shipping channels, the main shipping channel, and then also a shipping channel that goes to the Fraser shipyards. It carries 33,000 cars a day. And if I look at a, and the Bong Bridge carries about 15,000 cars a day. If I look at a map of our communities, Duluth and Superior, where people live, where people want to go, those that commute from downtown or to downtown to work in Duluth or from Duluth to Superior most likely are going to use the Blatnik Bridge as their main commuter route because it's the shortest distance between the two communities if you live in the communities. So that's why the traffic is proportionally higher on the Blatnik Bridge. It's jointly owned by MnDOT and Wisconsin DOT. It was built in 1960, and we share responsibility for leading projects on the bridges. MnDOT has agreed to share all or take on the lead for all work on the Blatnik Bridge, and WISDOT has been the lead agency on the Bong Bridge. So that's the way we share work, we share costs 50-50. So Blatnik Bridge is one that we studied pretty in depth after the I-35 collapse. And we learned that we had some concerns with the main span of the bridge, the truss, and particularly the gusset plates that hold the components of the truss together. And in 2008, in 2012, and in 2016, we did extensive rehab, strengthening kind of reactionary repair projects to the bridge to maintain legal load carrying capacity on the bridge. It's currently posted at 80,000 pounds, which is just legal truck loads. No permit loads at all are allowed on that bridge. We do a safety inspection every year. It's considered non-redundant. So if one member fails of the bridge, we're concerned if one member were to fail of the bridge. We're making sure that it's safe, though, with those inspection and maintenance projects that we're doing. We are concerned, though, about the serviceability of this bridge over a long period of time. And we've been spending quite a bit of effort in studying the bridge to determine when the appropriate time to consider replacement was. We did a management plan back in 2014. At that time, the management plan indicated that within 15 years, we should be planning to replace the main span of the bridge. So we're just starting to undertake the environmental process to consider what to do with the bridge. It could be replace the main span and rehab the approaches, or it could be replace the whole thing, depending on what the environmental process brings about. We know that there are significant issues with the approaches that would also have to be addressed if we were to rehab the approaches. So we're just starting that process. We're hoping that MnDOT has a placeholder in our 10-year plan for initial funding to begin in fiscal year 2028, which would mean if we are successful at working through the environmental process and the design process, we could begin construction in July of 2027. So that's kind of the time frame that we're working on, and we're hoping that we're able to get to the point where we can begin construction in 2027 with about a 3-year construction period. Right now, I struggle to say what the project's going to cost, because it depends on whether it's replace just the main span and rehab the approaches or replace the whole bridge. If it's replace the whole bridge, the number is in the $1 billion range.
Excuse me, what did you say the cost was?
Like, if we replace the whole bridge, it will be in the $1 billion range.
Okay. So what would more specifically that range entail?
It's too early to tell.
Okay.
It really is. We're just starting to learn. We're just starting to talk about it. We haven't determined what the alternative is yet.
Okay, that's
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
I was with the Wisconsin Secretary earlier in the week, and he and I have talked about this quite a bit. They do a different process for their major projects like this. They have to go to the legislature for specific project-by-project allocation, and I think we both are ballparking this in at $500 million on each side for where we need to zero in. And so that's why you're starting to see us talk about this already in terms of being able to assemble the funding package so that we can do the environmental work, so we can do the planning work with Wisconsin to get things moving along.
Thank you. That's helpful to know. Okay, continue.
All right. So one of the other issues that you probably frequently hear about from northeastern Minnesota for transportation is the Cross Range Expressway. Back in the late 1980s, there was an EIS completed that described expanding Highway 169 from Grand Rapids to the town of Pengilly from 2 lanes to 4 lanes. And at that time, we had 4 lanes from Pengilly to Virginia on Highway 169. So Highway 169 is a major commuter route for people that work in the mining industry. And all of the communities along Highway 169 have community members that make that commute on a regular basis. So over the last many years, MnDOT has done several projects to start to expand this corridor from 2 lanes to 4 lanes. And we've done about one every 10 years, one project. Today we have a little over seven miles remaining in the corridor where it's 2 lane, so basically a gap in the idea of that 4-lane corridor. So we started working at Grand Rapids, and we started working our way east with the 4-lane expansion. And so I just kind of want to bring this up as in that this is one of our unfunded needs that our local communities are really concerned about. Our current estimate for doing this work is between $130 and $170 million to expand that last 7.5 miles from 2-lane to 4-lane. It goes through several small communities. It goes through past mine dumps that require a lot of excavation and some sensitive wetland. So there's a lot of environmental issues to be addressed with the project, which drives the cost up as you try to work in that area. In the interim, because we don't have anything programmed, We are working on a safety improvement project for next year in the remaining corridor where we have two lanes. We're looking at adding turn lanes in some locations where there's been development and there are not turn lanes. And we're also looking at improving the sight distance on some of the vertical curves, so it's very hilly terrain, and we have a lot of crest curves that you can't see over the top of, so we're going to try to trim the top off those crest curves so that you have better sight distance. And then kind of the last thing that we've done as a commitment to the community is to continue to look at the needs for this four-lane expansion project. So we know it's probably something more than we can bite off in one piece because of the cost. So we're trying to figure out how to break that remaining segment into logical projects and update the cost estimate so they have the tools to talk to you about their priorities. I'm going to skip ahead a couple of slides in my presentation to talk about weather resiliency, and then I'll go back to Mission Creek. So in our region, we've experienced quite a few weather events in the last 8 years that I've been involved with. The photo on the slide presentation is from the 2012 flood that we have. This is Highway 210 where it crosses the St. Louis River right below Thompson Dam. And the approach to the bridge washed out during that flood event. My memory is a little bit foggy, but the flow in the river was somewhere around 60,000 cubic feet per second, and the previous record flow was in the 40,000 cubic foot per second range. I think we had about 12 inches of rain concentrated in the Duluth area in a very short duration on top of saturated ground when this event occurred. It was really significant for our whole local system. Almost every road in the region was impacted, regardless of whether it was a township road, a city street, a county road, or MnDOT's highways. So in that event, MnDOT's cost was in the $75 million range, and I'm sure St. Louis County and the city of Duluth probably matched that or more with the damage on their systems. We've also experienced wind events in 2016, 17, and actually 18 and 19. We've had wind events with the high water in Lake Superior, we had damage along the lake's shoreline. Those events mostly affect the local transportation system, but MnDOT's occurred damage when we've had trees basically fall on a right-of-way onto the roadway, and we've had to do major cleanup efforts in different corridors with these wind events. In 2018, we had a localized flooding event where we had a bridge washout on Highway 23. And we've experienced a snow event last week that was one of the 10th biggest snows, or in the top 10 big largest snow events in Duluth. During that event, we had to shut down a portion of I-35 because the snow fall rate was so great we couldn't keep up with snow plowing. We had semis stuck. We had other cars stuck, and then we had our plows stuck in the snow as they were trying to plow out the traffic that was stuck. We ended up having the interstate shut down for more than 12 hours while we could clear everybody out of there and get it open and safe and passable again. That snow event last week, we had our MnDOT crews worked from Friday till Friday, 12 on, 12 off. The cost of that work was about $1.5 million. Spent about $600,000 in equipment, $500,000 in labor, and $400,000 in materials just in that one event. And our plow trucks drove 84,000 miles. So kind of as a wrap up to this resiliency thing, we have a couple of flood mitigation projects that we're currently working on. The South Fork of the Maggie River on Highway 23 washed out in 2018. It was a box culvert, and all the soil around the box culvert washed out. We did a temporary repair to put it back in place, but our practices with resiliency kind of cause us to look at the size of the waterway opening when these events occur, and we've worked with Federal Highway, and they've agreed to fund an emergency repair project to do a permanent repair. So this next summer, we're going to replace that culvert with a bridge with a bigger waterway opening. Part of the problem on the Nemadji River was that the woody debris that came down the stream plugged up the culvert, and then the water forced its way around the culvert and washed away the roadbed around the culvert. So This project will replace that box culvert with a bridge that allows the trees and other woody debris coming down the stream to pass underneath the bridge. And then I'll talk more about Mission Creek, but Mission Creek is basically the same story. Oops, I gotta go back the other way. So maybe I'll use this as an example. There's photos on this slide of the Fond du Lac neighborhood in the very west end of Duluth from 2012. The air photo in the lower right shows the flooding impacts from the 2012 storm in the neighborhood above Highway 23, where the Mission Creek Bridge exists. And the photo in the upper left is a picture of the bridge itself with some of the woody debris at the entrance of the bridge. After the rain stopped coming down during that event and the water started receding, we had three blocks of trees from the bridge upstream, and it caused all the water that came down that creek to flow basically through the neighborhood and through people's homes. So there's many, many homes in that neighborhood where the people are very anxious about what happens next time there's a storm. And they really encourage MnDOT to look at replacing the bridge at Mission Creek with something that would pass the woody debris. So we endeavored to do a project to replace that box culvert with a bridge. And we started work on it in 2017. So we started work on replacing the culvert with a bridge in 2017. We started in early May. The week before Memorial Weekend, we got a call that said, hey, we think that you've inadvertently disturbed a historic cemetery that was unmarked. And we stopped work. Unfortunately, we found that we had disturbed a cemetery with our excavation work. And over the last 2.5 years, we've put a significant effort into recovering the human remains that were disturbed by our excavation. Now we're at the point where we've stabilized the cemetery slope that was disturbed, and we're just in the beginning stages of reconsidering the environmental process to replace this this culvert with a bridge in a way that avoids the cultural resource in the neighborhood. Mission Creek, this particular neighborhood, as you learn about the history, you learn that this is the first rapids on the St. Louis River. It was a really good place to camp and live, fish and hunt, gather wild rice over many, many hundreds and thousands of years prior to settlement. Once this area was settled, this area was the beginning of the Great Northern Railroad, and it was also a first fur trading post. So there's a rich history in the neighborhood that for somehow, as we developed our project, we were totally missed the fact that there was a history to it. So we're in the process of trying to correct the mistake that was made with that project and then do the right thing for the neighborhood and kind of relieve their anxiety about flooding.
So if we could just maybe wrap up this section here. I hope maybe you're able to maybe transition us to the NLX piece.
Yeah.
And then we'll start our bill hearing.
My name is Frank Letterly. I am the NLX project manager for MnDOT. And I know that many of you are familiar with the Northern Lights Express project, but just a very quick review. Intercity passenger rail service that would connect Minneapolis Target Field to the Duluth Depot with intermediate stations in Coon Rapids, Cambridge, Hinckley, and Superior. The route is 152 miles, and it's entirely on existing BNSF railway track. The proposed service plan is for 90 mile per hour top speed with an average speed of 60 miles per hour. The average speed includes the time that it takes to stop at the intermediate stations. So there would be about a 2.5 hour travel time between Minneapolis and Duluth, and that would be using modern equipment. I should point out that the selection of 90 miles per hour in four round trips was based upon a very detailed benefit cost analysis in which we reviewed several different speeds, 79, 90, and 110, and several different frequencies, 2, 4, 6, and 8 frequencies, and we looked at all of those different service options and determined that the best benefit cost ratio was the four round trips at 90 miles per hour. I'm going to go to the next one. we have finished planning for this project. In fact, we finished quite some time ago. We received a Tier 2 project level EA from the Federal Railroad Administration, in February of 2018, which means that we have a preferred alignment, we have the preliminary engineering for track improvements identified, we have assessed the impacts of the alignment footprint and completed an environmental analysis. So planning is complete. Next slide. And what's next? Well, we need to secure the capital funding. We need to secure the operating funding. We need to complete all the necessary agreements with BNSF and Amtrak. Amtrak, because we assume that Amtrak will be our operator, and BNSF, because BNSF owns the track. Amtrak, you may know, has the authority by statute to operate over the freight railroads, and so that is why we've selected Amtrak as our operator. We also need to procure equipment either through purchase or through lease, and we've been discussing the lease option with Amtrak. So then we would need to go into final design and construction and implement the service. Service could begin about 2.5 years from the initiation of final design. And that's the summary.
Thank you, Commissioner. Did you want to add anything?
Well, Mr. Chair, I just want to say that the department is very interested, and the governor and lieutenant governor are also very interested in being able to increase passenger rail options, including Northern Lights Express. And so there has been a lot of support from the administration already for particularly this project and another project that you looked at earlier in the fall, which through the Winona mini session, and that's the second train to Chicago. And both of these routes, we believe, make sense in Minnesota and would be highly utilized.
Well, thank you. And before we move into the bill hearing, I wanted to see if any committee members had any questions about any of the projects that were discussed. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. It seems like one of the concerns that we might have is in agreements with BNSF and Amtrak. How are those negotiations? I mean, what's the preliminary discussions there, and what is their status?
I believe that you're going to be hearing from Derek James from Amtrak later in the session, and he'll discuss part of that. But what I understand is that Amtrak is very excited about operating the service. We would be classified as what's known as a state-supported train, which is one of their business lines, and they would be perfectly willing to come in and help us plan it and figure out how to do it. Now, as far as the negotiations are concerned, there's a federal act called PREA that defines the manner in which we negotiate with Amtrak and defines the cost categories and the standard costs that we would have to pay to Amtrak for operations. BNSF, we have been discussing with BNSF all along for the past several years. They're fully aware that we're hoping to do this. We have discussed with them the types of improvements that we need to make. I believe that MnDOT has a very good relationship with BNSF with respect to the Northern Lights Express. But their position right now is that once we have the funding to proceed, then we can sit down and do final negotiation.
Representative Petersburg.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, that's very interesting to know, because I think that the parties, BNSF and Amtrak, need to be certainly at the table. And I'm it sounds to me like you've had discussions with them currently as well in regards to this track. And so you're feeling like you've got all the bases covered. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Thank you. And I just wanted to personally thank you, Commissioner, for making the trip up here, and to Mr. Letterly and Mr. Hill. And I think I especially appreciate, you know, your overview of the two, you know, very important large projects that are taking place here on the highway and bridge side, but also your attentiveness to the fact that, you know, our climate is changing, and it seems that every week there's another study that affirms that, and in fact it talks about the accelerating rate of climate change, and it's clearly been an impact in this part of the state. So I appreciate your attentiveness to that. So before I call on our colleague Representative Murphy to present her bill, I understand that Representative Mason has a comment.
Just a short one. Many years ago when I was a Girl Scout leader, I just remember bringing my troop here to Duluth on the railroad. That was one of our most exciting trips that we took, or any experience. So I was just really saddened when that was stopped.
Commissioner, one last question here before you leave.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
These are important projects that, you know, have seemed to me that have been, you know, on the books for a while. And one of the things that I've said often is that, transportation projects don't go away. They just get more expensive when we don't address them in a timely way. And how much of that in this region is due to the fact that we have just had, just stagnant funding really for a long time? Has that been a factor in some of the delays here?
Well, Mr. Chair, first of all, I want to say that the issue of both infrastructure resiliency and the climate go hand in hand for MnDOT. We need to pay attention to both of these things together, and that's what you see Duane and his team doing through their planning efforts, and I want to compliment him on that. He is doing an excellent job. I want him to stay in his role so that we can complete Twin Ports Interchange and Blatnik Bridge. I don't know if I'll get him all the way through Blatnik Bridge, but he is a real talent. I also think it's fair to say that although there has been some funding infusion over the last few years, a little bit of the general fund coming in, and thank you for the work that you did do on that, Representative Torkelson, when you were chair. It was important to our system. It is not enough for what our plans are and what the needs are across the state. And I think that that is where, you all and your ability to come together around such a vital, important topic like transportation in all modes is going to be very important in the next number of months, because being able to really put that infusion of dollars into the system. MnDOT has a number of areas, and we could be here in Duluth, we could be in southern Minnesota looking at the Highway 14 rest of that project. We could look at Highway 23. We could look at 94. There's places everywhere in this state where there's a long list of needs. And I think that it's fair to say that working together, I do believe that you can all bring together some ideas that would provide some new funding sources and maybe refresh some of the sources with an update to them that have been dependable for the Department of Transportation, dedicated by the Constitution to the need that is out there. And so that is, we hope to continue to provide for you the information about what our 4-year plan, our 10-year plan, and our 20-year plan would do for Minnesotans. But to make them a reality, more funding is needed.
Well, thank you. And again, thank you for your work. And we appreciate that very much. We are now going to transition to a bill hearing. Our members are aware of this, but just for the public, House File 387, we're not going to take any votes today. This is an informational hearing. This bill isn't even in the Transportation Committee. It's in Representative Murphy's Capital Investment Committee. But oftentimes the Transportation Committee will hear on an informational basis a legislation that's transportation related. So House File 387 is about NLX. That's transportation related. And as Representative Murphy makes her way up here, I did want to just acknowledge we are going to have several of our local representatives actually testifying, but I did want to acknowledge all of them at this point, because they are amazing. They've done incredible work, not only on transportation, but a variety of issues. I'm very pleased to serve with them. We have Representative Mike Sundin in the back from Carlton County, and then our two Duluth state representatives, Representative Liz Olson, Representative Jennifer Schultz, are here in the front row, and we'll be hearing from them directly. So, the star of the show, Representative Murphy, it's great to be in your neck of the woods as well, and thank you for your leadership of the Capital Investment Committee. Representative Murphy has led many tours all across the state. I don't even know what the data is, how many different projects, how many different cities you have visited over the last several months here, but it's incredible amount of work, and you've led it very well, and we look forward to a very robust bonding bill coming up this session. And so with that, I will introduce Representative Murphy, who will talk again about House File 387, and then members will and members of the public, and no votes here today, just hearing the bill, hearing information, having a back and forth, our many witnesses that have signed up to discuss this bill, and of course our committee. So welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am pleased to be here. Almost every year this century, I have appeared before the Transportation Committee with my bill, whatever number it might be. This year, it's House File 387. And I know that House File 387 is not high speed, but 90 is a lot better than 40. And I know that it's been heard. In days gone by, on December 4th, it was mentioned in the Duluth News Tribune that local leaders interested in returning Amtrak passenger service between the cities and Duluth could come to a public hearing on December 4th, 1999. That was 6 months after Representative Willard Munger had passed away. And Representative Willard Munger was my predecessor in carrying the bill between with the train service from Duluth to Minneapolis-St. Paul. This is a new century. And one thing I learned in those 17 days of traveling the state, thousands of miles, and you were wise enough to select Minnesota coaches and bus driver Steve to bring you to Duluth today. And that's a very smart decision, because I'm convinced he's the best bus driver on the road for Minnesota coaches. And he's put up with us on 15-hour days for 17 days. In September, October, and November. And I appreciate his service, and I'm so glad that you are appreciating his service today. But buses haven't always been on the highways either. And yet today, bus service between the Twin Cities and Duluth has never been as good as it is today. Shuttle services are going. People need options, and people want options. And on those, on that tour, the tours that I made, I heard from people in every town that want to be connected to the next town. And on every single trail bill or park bill that we heard testimony about on those tours, people were saying, well, we have our trail, and the next town has their trail. Now, can we have bonding money for the connection? Commissioner Anderson spoke about options. People are looking for every kind of option they can find to get from one place to another. And our populations are growing. And our populations need connections. Whether it's in the space or whether it's on the ground on fixed rail tracks that connect the nation and has always connected the nations since the 1860s. And those railroads came about because of government action and government funding. The land for the first railroads across the nation was free for the railroads that were going to connect with each other, east to west, north to south. Commissioner mentioned the train to Chicago, but there's people that want to go to St. Louis, and there's people that want to go to Colorado and to the Northwest, to the Pacific Northwest, and they want to do it by train. And we don't know that no one will use it. Of course there's the naysayers that have a car and a destination and somebody's house to stay overnight at. They want to go down to see the grandkids once a month or so. But there's other people that want to ride the train so that they can do their business with Wi-Fi and have a cup of coffee and make phone calls. And that wasn't in the last century. That is in this century. And so there's new opportunities now. And why now do we need to put those options back on the tracks? Because we can. Because for the first time that I've been carrying the bill, Amtrak's interested. The Commissioner of Transportation is interested. The Speaker of the House of Representatives is interested. And the Rangers are interested too, because if we get the train going from Duluth to Minneapolis to St. Paul to Chicago to the St. Louis, to Colorado, to the Pacific Northwest, to Northeast. The Rangers want a train from Duluth to the West Range and the East Range. So we can't say to the we can't stand with the naysayers that say, oh no, everybody's going to drive and it's just going to be another waste of money. We have to learn how to travel into the future. And with all these things going for us from interested parties, and I have sat in the meeting and on these trips that we've made where towns are asking for connector things and for the trunk highway projects that I haven't looked at yet because I think that's the Transportation Committee's prerogative to do. I've heard that there's a need for bonding money, for a robust bonding bill. And I know we've already got a bill in the House Ways and Means Committee for $1.5 billion. And I know how to say $3.5 billion. And some people are having a little trouble with that. But what does robust mean? If we're planning for the 21st century, which we are in, and 20 years have gone by of that already, we have to have something in place for the rest of the 80 years to follow. And that is the Northern Lights Express to start with, plus those other things that would connect one part of the highway to another part of the highway, the trunk highway stuff. Just practice saying robust. Practice saying, commissioners with us. the speakers with us. The chair is with us. The lead of the minority likes trains. Boats, ports. The speaker, or the lead transportation person used to be in my seat as chair. He knows the trials and tribulations, and he's willing to talk. He might not say robust as rapidly as I say robust, or 3 billion as fast as I say 3 billion, but he knows what we need for the future, and we have discussions to take place. And that's why I'm going round about the words that are in House File 387, because other people are going to speak here. And this isn't just a Minnesota bill, because the next speaker is the mayor of Superior. And then after that, Liz Olson is going to talk, because we need her bill, too, in order to get the Northern Lights Express on the rails, because Grassy Point has to be improved. And that's in addition to 387. Or it could be combined with. But our opportunity for the next 80 years in this century is here before us, and will be before us throughout this coming session that starts in February. And so I thank you for coming and listening, and invite you to seize the moment and remember the dreams of Representative Willard Munger. But let's bring our grandchildren into this century by thinking a train is a usual option that can be met every single day.
Thank you so much, Chair Murphy. And does anyone, yeah, people can cheer. Does anyone have questions for the author, by the way? Any questions? Okay. And just to underline, the chair is with you, too. The chair is with you, too. Mayor Payne, welcome to the committee. And we also have Jason Cirque, the chairman of the NLX Alliance, I believe.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Ranking Member, and members of the committee, thank you very much for allowing me the opportunity to speak on behalf of the Northern Lights Express. My name is Jim Payne. I am the mayor of Superior, Wisconsin, which we like to think of as even greater Minnesota. There are a number of great reasons to live in Wisconsin, but one particularly large drawback is that I will never have the privilege of voting for Representative Mary Murphy. Which, well, a tragedy. At least I get to express my gratitude for her putting forward this bill and speaking on behalf of all of us that live in the North and believing and understanding that we only build a better future if we do it together. I have been a passionate supporter of the Northern Lights Express and commuter rail for as long as I've been involved in politics, which by my count has been just about as long as I've been alive. I've been supporting this bill as a member of the Metropolitan Interstate Council here in the Twin Ports while I served on the Douglas County Board, and have now reaffirmed my commitment to it as the mayor of Superior. Minnesota is a part of our lives in northern Wisconsin. We are a great distance away from a lot of the Wisconsin metropolitan areas. And so the Twin Cities metro area is the place where a lot of us do some of our larger shopping. We visit your malls and your downtown spaces. We fly out of your airports. We frequently have the pleasure of watching the Brewers and the Packers win in the Twin Cities. I'm doing a poor job at getting you to support this bill, but my point is that we are one community economically and culturally, and this train brings us closer together. It is good for our economy because it brings customers to businesses. It brings employees to employers. It brings our cultures together by allowing more people more affordable access to art and to science and to education, to entertainment, to music and cultural experiences. And it improves the quality of life for the citizens of Minnesota and Wisconsin. I'm mostly here, members of the committee, to tell you that Wisconsin is ready to be a partner in this project. I have personally spoken to Governor Evers and Secretary of Transportation, Mr. Craig Thompson, who both adamantly support this project and are willing to assist in funding this project. In fact, the first personal conversation I ever had with then Governor-elect Tony Evers, before I could speak about the issues that were important to me and to Northern Wisconsin, he interrupted to ask about the Northern Lights Express. This is something that is of personal interest to the governor. It is of personal interest to many of the people of Northern Wisconsin. We want to be a part of your economy and culture, and we want the people of Minnesota to be a part of our culture and economy so that we can all grow together. So thank you again for your consideration. I urge your vocal support for Representative Murphy's bill, as well as the ongoing efforts to put this train on the tracks. To speak more about it, I've invited my Port and Planning Director for the City of Superior, Mr. Jason Cirque.
Thank you, Mayor, and welcome to the committee, Mr. Cirque.
Thank you, and good afternoon, Chair Horstein and members of the Minnesota House Transportation Committee. My name is Jason Cirque, and I'm the Economic Development Planning and Port Director for the City of Superior. I am also lucky enough to be the board chair for the Joint Powers Alliance, which oversees the Northern Lights Express. Many of you may know also Minneapolis Councilman Andrew Johnson, who is the co-chair. We've been in that capacity for about 2 years and have really learned a lot and enjoying every minute of it, and kind of humbled about all the past that has been work that has been done into this and seeing it come to fruition that others have laid the groundwork for. Thank you again for making the trip to the Twin Ports today. Since joining, and I just kind of want to reiterate what the mayor had said, since joining about 4 or 5 years ago on the board, participation and cooperation between Wisconsin and Minnesota has really seen an uptick. I also have to give credit to not only our administration but our city council for continuing to fund our participation on the board. That hasn't happened in the past, and I think the council is seeing, as well as our administration, the economic development, the tourism and commuting benefits that this could happen for our region. I believe the city's renewed interest in Northern Lights Express has piqued the interest of the Wisconsin state, not only at the state level, but also at the federal level. So, and we're kind of seeing, as the mayor said, some motion in the right direction at this time. So that's more or less what I had to say, just to introduce you to who I am, as well as to kind of kick this hearing off.
Thank you so much. Are there any questions for our guests from Wisconsin? Yes, Representative Mason.
Thank you. Just a quick comment. I get a number of comments from constituents and other people who are living in Minnesota that when they go abroad, they are constantly able to travel so easily using the trains that they have there, and they just don't understand why we have that here. So I appreciate you coming here. And I went as far as Superior. My son used to play hockey, and we used to come for a tournament every January. 1 year we stayed at a hotel in Superior. We're driving through a snow tunnel. The snow was packed like 3 feet above our car. And then I think that first night almost all the cars were frozen. We couldn't use the cars the next day. It was so cold. But again, I appreciate your comments today.
We're so happy you enjoyed Superior. We like that too.
Yeah. Thank you very much
for coming.
Thank you.
And our next testifier is Ken Bueller, the chair of the NLX Technical Advisory Committee. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Bueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for coming, and thank you all for this great opportunity this afternoon. And Commissioner Kelleher, thank you and welcome to Duluth. I am the chair of the Northern Lights Express Technical Advisory Committee, but in my real job, I am the executive director for the Lake Superior Railroad Museum at the St. Louis County Heritage and Arts Center, the depot in downtown Duluth, and general manager of the North Shore Scenic Railroad, which will share that depot with NLX. We have been working on this project since its inception, which was one Sunday afternoon in Congressman Jim Oberstar's Chisholm office on Minnesota's glorious Iron Range, and that was well over 12 years ago. While the Congressman is no longer with us, many of his transportation and infrastructure initiatives in Minnesota are here, and this train will be another one of them. We've accomplished a lot in 12 years, and in the history of rail projects, a dozen years is not a long time. For instance, from its inception to completion, the building of the Transcontinental Railway, mentioned by Representative Murphy, which, by the way, celebrated its 150th anniversary this year on May 10th, and it changed America. But it took 18 years of planning and seven more years to build. Just like the first train to travel across America, the Northern Lights Express is a train that will change everything. Right now, we're in the middle of a five-year strategic plan for completion of the project. We have the most critical part of the work done, accomplished, the finding of no significant impact, or FONSI, which gives NLX access to federal funding in programs like CRISI and BUILD, money that we plan to leverage with the bonding bills being discussed here this afternoon. The NLX strategic plan calls for building in phases in cooperation with the Minnesota Department of Transportation, because this is a state-sponsored initiative, and you'll hear more about that later from our colleagues. So very quickly, here's where we are right now. As you heard from Mr. Letterly, the existing BNSF tracks between downtown Duluth and Target Field in Minneapolis, 150 miles of which, will carry four trains a day with stops in Superior, Wisconsin, Hinckley, Cambridge, North Foley. Top speed will be 90 miles an hour, making travel time comparable to a trip by automobile, about 2 hours and 25 minutes. Cost of the tickets will vary, as it does with airlines, but our best average estimate is between $30 and $38 a ticket one way. The line last saw passenger travel between 1975 and 1985, and that was when Mayor Larson and her family rode on it to come to Duluth. It was called the North Star back then and operated by Amtrak. Contrary to what was happening on other Amtrak routes at that time, though, North Star ridership was actually increasing in the years before the train itself was canceled, Easter Sunday, 1985. The last train leaves the depot in downtown Duluth. Now ask yourself, what has changed since 1985 that will ensure the success of Northern Lights Express today? In 1985, gas was 87 cents a gallon. In 1985, traffic congestion on I-35, especially south of Forest Lake, wasn't even being considered. 35 years ago, there wasn't a grand casino in Hinckley. In our passenger computer models, the comings and goings from the casino contribute to NLX ridership like it was a city of hundreds of thousands of people. And in 1985, two things didn't even exist that have changed everyone's life today. The cell phone and the laptop computer. Two things didn't exist then that we depend on constantly and that you can't use while you're driving. So your train ride becomes, instead of windshield time, productive time. Or as I tell my attorney friends, billable hours. Consider also the overwhelming shift in our attitudes towards travel. Former Transportation Secretary Anthony Fox said it best when speaking about NLX. He said, "Millennials don't want a car, they want a ride. Today we have Uber and Lyft, and that's why the Gen Zs and Millennials have the lowest percentage of driver's licenses than any earlier generation." Finally, the way we travel today is important to how we'll leave the planet tomorrow. As was mentioned earlier, per passenger mile, rail transportation has the lowest carbon footprint of any other form of transportation other than cruise ships. I don't think we're going to get a cruise line to operate between Duluth and Minneapolis. And then, as also mentioned, there's the weather. 2 weeks ago, Saturday, November 30th, Sunday, December 1st, winter comes to Minnesota with a vengeance. That 24-inch blizzard closed I-35 from Thompson Hill down to Scanlan, cutting Duluth off from the south for half a day. There was no bus service to Duluth that day, or much bus service in Duluth. Our airport was closed. In Minneapolis, at MSP, they canceled almost 60 flights, and in the Midwest, a total of more than 200 flights were canceled, and 1,000 more were delayed. On Sunday, December 1st, as the storm did its worst, Amtrak's Empire Builder from the West Coast to St. Paul that morning was 53 minutes late. The Empire Builder from Chicago to the West that evening was 4 minutes late. Trains are slowed by the weather, but rarely stopped. And when this train, the Northern Lights Express, starts running, it will be a train that will change everything. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mueller. Any questions? Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. These are just a couple of technical questions. I think when you said there would be four trips, that's four round trips a day, correct?
Correct.
And thank you. And your fare, you said it was between $35 and $38. Do you know what the actual cost per rider would be for that?
Mr. Mueller.
Yes. Representative, the actual subsidies will be in place. You're correct. There will be a ongoing subsidy. That, of course, depends on the number of passengers as it goes down. It also depends, quite honestly, on the negotiations with Amtrak that you'll hear about later from Mr. James. So whether there will be full fare box recovery is highly unlikely. However, our projections show that the fare box recovery will be well above a commuter line because it's inner city, and those do have a higher fare box recovery. But also because of our ridership projection, we're expecting fare box recovery somewhere right around in the high 80s.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. Just clarification, it's always important to know, you know, what we're getting into, because ongoing expectations and ongoing expenses sometimes kill projects, and so it's important for us to have that information. So thank you very much.
I agree, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you again. Appreciate your work on this and your testimony. Now we have Representatives Olson and Representative Schultz. And thank you so much, Representatives, for welcoming us here and your wonderful advocacy of this project and your interest in having us come here. So very appreciative of that. And you want to go first, Representative Olson?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and welcome to Duluth. Glad to have you here. So as Representative Murphy mentioned, one piece of the bill or one piece of this project is a component that's actually carried in another bill, which is House File 2838, which is the Grassy Point Bridge. So I'm just going to talk very briefly on that as a part of this. But this is a bridge that is a critical connection between Wisconsin and Minnesota, and not just would be important for NLX, but is also a component of the freight and the work that we do here in the Duluth Port. And you'll hear more about port and freight and other issues as we move forward. So the equipment that operates the swing bridge needs to be upgraded and restored to be able to handle NLX and the future build-out. But it gets used currently all of the time in the way our port operates, the way our shipping goes through, the way our trains operate. So it's already in need of repair, but would also be a critical piece of what we need to do in order to enable NLX to run, as we heard, between Wisconsin and Minnesota. So we had a recent failure, I think it was about 3 weeks, someone could probably give us specifics, where that was completely inoperable, and we weren't able to have our freight be carried across that bridge, which is a major, major component of the Duluth economy and a big part of what we need. So as much as we need this both for the NLX project, it's really important just for freight and general work we need to do in Duluth to maintain our port and our economy here. So
thank you, Representative Olson. Welcome, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair and members of the Transportation Committee. Welcome to my district.
I'm so glad you could come and hear about the NLX train and all the support that we have for it in our community. I just want to briefly touch on a few things, and that is the importance of the NLX route and public transportation to college students. So as many of you know, in my other job, I'm a professor at UMD and have been surrounded by college students for over my 20-plus career. And there's been a lot of research that shows that millennials, college students, even those all the way up to age 37, prefer not to own a car because of the cost of maintenance. And we're seeing a real cultural shift among younger generations that shows that they support a sharing economy, and that includes car sharing. And UMD does have car sharing available. We also want to limit the costs of building more parking lots. So the NLX train route will help UMD save money in the future by reducing the number of cars that students bring to campus. There's been recent surveys done throughout the Midwest and in Minnesota that shows that in a recent survey of college students who live along Amtrak routes in 9 Midwestern states, that nearly over a one-quarter or one-fourth of respondents said they had taken Amtrak to and from school, with two-thirds indicating passenger rail service as an important resource to attend college. In a more local survey of college students along Amtrak's route for Minnesota State College, Southeast St. Mary, University of Minnesota, and Winona State University, they found that 62% of respondents said they consider passenger rail service to be important or very important to the future of transportation in the U.S. 55% said they would be more likely to take the train that already services Winona if there were more frequent services available. And that 41% said that they have taken the train at least once to or from their Winona area school. So it is a very important resource today for college students, and it's really going to leave Duluth and Superior behind if we don't fund this NLX passenger rail route. The University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire and community members in Eau Claire, Wisconsin have formed a coalition, and they're right now investigating rail service between Eau Claire and St. Paul. And as you may know, UW-Eau Claire is a competitor to many of our colleges, including UMD in Minnesota. And my fear is that if we don't get ahead of this and start seriously funding the NLX and putting in the $4 million with Mary Murphy's bill, that other communities in Wisconsin will be ahead of us and leave our community behind and our state behind. So we really want to educate our own Minnesota students rather than sending them outside the state to help retention of professionals who are educated in our state. So I want to thank students here that have been working on transportation issues as part of the UMD Transportation Club and other activities here, and I hope that many of them will testify about their support for passenger rail. And I want to thank you again for considering Mary Murphy's bill and Representative Olson's bill.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. I love the fact that there's a transportation club here. Are there any questions for any of our wonderful Duluth colleagues? Okay, well, thank you very much, and thank you for your welcome to your town. Our next speaker or testifier is Bob Manzolini, Executive Director of the NLX Alliance. Oh, okay. I see that you're coming up together with Mr. James, which is great. And if each of you can, before you speak, identify yourself for the record. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Bob Manzoline with the St. Louis and Lake County Regional Rail Authority, also working for the Minneapolis-Duluth-Superior Intercity Passenger Rail Alliance, which is a consortium of counties, cities along the route that have come together to work on the project. You know, we've heard from the chair and others from the group, been working many years on a project cooperatively with the state of Minnesota, with MnDOT on this for quite a while. And with me is Mr. James.
Thank you, Mr. Manzoline. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Derek James, Senior Manager of Government Affairs for Amtrak.
Welcome.
Firstly, we'd just like to talk a bit about, you know, what we're asking for during this next bonding cycle. A project of this size, they're generally built what's called, you know, incrementally in pieces, you know, parts at a time. Rather than trying to overcome the total project cost of $550 million, we've had several scenarios of how we can build this over a number of years, 3 to 5 years. And looking at, you know, one scenario, we've talked about firstly going out and improving the crossings and the bridges along the line, secondly building stations and facilities, and acquiring improving tracks and signals, and then finally getting the train sets and building it in that manner. Right now, we feel that the two best things to do at this point in time are to improve these sections of the rail line that are going slow. You can get a lot faster train speed by improving the slow sections to a faster speed rather than the fast sections faster. And there's two choke points along the rail line, one right here in Duluth. It's the Burlington Northern Swing Bridge right in the harbor. It's fairly unreliable. The speed across that bridge right now is 5 miles per hour. We'd like to increase that speed to at least 30. The cost for that improvement is about $10 million. The second project is what we call the Third Main. It's in the North Town Yard, the Burlington Northern Santa Fe North Town Yard. It's a rail line that would circumvent or go around the yard. And that would create additional capacity needed, not only for the Northern Lights Express trains, but also for the freight railroads themselves, and also for Amtrak service out to the West Coast, and also North Star train. You know, right now it's going out to Big Lake, and there's been talk about, you know, the extension out to St. Cloud. That area around Northtown is so congested that I doubt very much the St. Cloud line could be constructed without this Third Main project. That's how difficult it is there. 90 trains a day pass through that area, freight, and intercity rail, transit rail. So those are the two projects we're proposing here. Total cost on those is $81 million. The Third Main project is $60 million. So that's what we're proposing. One thing that Frank Letterly with MnDOT mentioned is Amtrak possibly coming in and operating the train. And if they were to operate, they'd also maintain the trains. In our total cost of $550 million, we have in there $80 million to buy train sets. We also have in there $120 million to construct maintenance facilities and stations. Those costs could be, I wouldn't say diverted, but could be part of Amtrak's operation of the facility, which would significantly drop the capital costs in this project down from 550. We don't have the exact numbers yet, but it would be a significant reduction in the overall project costs. Derek's done this in other states. I know Frank has been working on it. And maybe Derek can say something to that.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Mr. James. I think you get the medal for traveling the furthest to be here, and we appreciated that you were with us in Winona, and we really appreciate that you're here today. So welcome to the committee.
It's always my pleasure, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much. Thank you, other members of the committee, other legislators that are here, Mayor Payne and Mayor Larson. I always enjoy my trips to Duluth. Please have a hearing in the summer.
You're from Chicago.
I won't take very much of your time today reciting all the benefits that come to communities for having quality passenger rail service. Those have been well recounted here. You have very able advocates here in the Twin Ports area. What I will share, though, is Amtrak's perspective as the nation's primary passenger rail operator, working with a diverse set of states in implementing similar projects to this across the nation. Amtrak has just come off of the most successful year in our corporate history. We operate on the federal fiscal year, October to September. We assumed operation of most of the nation's passenger trains back in 1971. In the just-completed fiscal year, 2019, we carried more passengers than we ever have, 32.5 million people. We earned more revenue than we ever have, $3.3 billion. And we've invested more capital dollars in our network, $1.8 billion. And we had the lowest federal operating loss ever of $29 million. That's a drop of 82% from $171 million in fiscal year 18. And that is a decline from $400 million annually a decade ago. We are on track to finish this fiscal year, which we are in right now, with zero federal operating loss. That's unprecedented in U.S. transit. We're making enough profits on some of our services that we're able to cross-subsidize some of our money-losing services like the long-distance trains. That means that Amtrak is paying for its passenger rail operations, primarily with the fares that our passengers pay to ride the trains, the revenue that we are earning from our real estate assets, and the services we provide other railroads, and the contracts that we have with state governments to operate regional passenger services, like is being contemplated here in Minnesota. We've been able to approach this milestone, zero operating loss, by making strategic investments in our network that improve the passenger rail experience in partnership. That these investments have been made in partnership with the federal government, many state and local governments. Each entity that we work with sees the value in frequent, safe, reliable, trip time competitive passenger rail service, the benefits that that has for communities and regional economies. Such services, we insist, are the future of passenger rail, frequent service between cities that are close to each other. The ridership records that Amtrak has broken on services across the country, especially here in the Midwest even, have been made possible after freight railroad capacity and signal upgrades, new stations, new locomotives, and customer-facing technology enhancements that make it easier for riders to book and access trains. These upgrades have been paid for by funds from the federal government, state and local governments, and Amtrak, and there are more of those improvements to come, even in the Midwest. After years of schizophrenia over whether to invest in passenger rail, the U.S. Congress has been acting in bipartisan fashion to provide roughly $3 billion annually for passenger rail capital investments. Much of this money is in the form of grants available to states by application. States that have projects that are advancing to build out the network of passenger rail to augment the Amtrak system and even some private sector passenger rail initiatives. We've started new routes with the state of Virginia connecting Norfolk with Washington and New York and Roanoke with Washington and New York. With the state of Maine to connect Portland and Brunswick with Boston. Additional trains are being added on the BNSF between Seattle and Portland in cooperation with the states of Oregon and Washington. And new trains are also being added between Charlotte and Raleigh. North Carolina is very forward-thinking in terms of passenger rail. In the Midwest, the Chicago-Detroit and the St. Louis-Chicago corridors are experiencing double-digit ridership growth as state, federally funded track and station improvements drive passengers to our trains. The Amtrak St. Louis-Springfield-Chicago route broke ridership records this year, not seen since before the interstate was built connecting those cities. Detroit-Chicago trains are adding passengers at a fast clip. And our Milwaukee-Chicago trains, which we're very proud of, are bursting with standees as we scramble to find enough coaches to make those 7-car trains longer. It is two of those 14 daily trains between Chicago and Milwaukee, which we operate under contract for Wisconsin DOT, and we hope to extend the two of those trains to Minnesota, to the Twin Cities, to start to develop the Twin Cities Milwaukee-Chicago route into a multi-frequency corridor. Just this last legislative session, the Wisconsin legislature appropriated $35 million towards rail expansion, partly because of the success of Milwaukee-Chicago service. This year, we were able to deliver those services to the state of Wisconsin at no operating subsidy. The fares that the customers are paying now cover the cost of running those trains because people will flock to frequent on-time service. Business travelers will ride, tourists will ride, folks who have business in either city. So we're seeing that growth. That route broke 850,000 customers this last year, the most that have ever ridden. None of this success would be possible without, again, the federal-state Amtrak partnership. in order to continue to grow and meet the latent demand for better passenger rail service and provide connections that communities will need to thrive in a climate change future, we need the state of Minnesota, by advancing HF 387, to step up and join Wisconsin and Amtrak and bringing dollars to the table like we will, so an application can be made for the next round of federal grants to implement the second train to Milwaukee and Chicago and to begin construction, as Bob talked about, on the NLX corridor so we can resume passenger train service to here, the Twin Ports. The public continues to demonstrate that when quality, frequent, competitive passenger train service is available, they will use it. The data show it, our crowded trains show it. In my travels across the Midwest, and I have 15 states that I work with, including Minnesota, I meet with residents, passengers, local officials, and Amtrak-served communities all the time. They're always so proud of their stations and that they have Amtrak service that draws people from miles around to board our trains and to patronize their local businesses. They wanted a way to show off. We came up with a way for communities to show that pride that they have Amtrak. We made these signs that say Amtrak Serve Community that can be posted at the entrance to their towns. In a few years, I want Mayor Larson and Mayor Payne to be able to post these signs for all to see as people enter Duluth and Superior. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
Lastly, Mr. Chairman, as indicated by Bob, we are the Midwestern states a few years ago received a full federal funded grant to purchase 88 new passenger coaches and a fleet of locomotives to re-equip all of the state corridor trains that we operate in the Midwest under contract for Illinois, Michigan, Missouri, and Wisconsin. As those cars come online, they're being assembled in the United States by Siemens in California. We will displace the equipment that we're using now. We have been in discussions with Minnesota and Wisconsin to retain those cars, to upgrade them for use for service growth should routes like these two come to fruition.
Thank you. Mr. James, Mr. Manzalini, did you have one final comment, Mr. Manzalini?
Yes, Mr. Chair, if I could, you know, speaking about the federal funding that's available around the country, the Consolidated Rail Infrastructure Safety Improvement Program, what's called CRISI, funding has just been increasing year after year. In 2017, it was at $65 million. 2018, at $318 million. Also, the federal State of Good Repair Fund has been increasing from $272 million in 2018 to $396 million in 2019. So these federal funds for, you know, advancing these rail projects are there. Other states are receiving those funds. I don't think Minnesota has applied for or received those funds yet. But to give you an example, the states of Alabama, Louisiana, and Mississippi just received a grant in the amount of $32 million to fund a project almost the same as what we're proposing to you today. Reestablishment of intercity passenger rail across the Gulf Coast states. You know, with that, you know, we talk about project funding here. We are looking at, you know, requesting from the state $31 million of the 81.5. And we're also requesting $46.5 million from the feds to make this project happen. So there is we're asking the federal government for about 60% of the cost, the state to come up with 40%. That's where we're proposing this project move forward. Thank you.
And gentlemen, if you could stay, we have several questions from committee members. I'll start with Mr. Representative Heinrich and then Representative Runbeck, and then I have a question. So. Oh. And Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question is for Mr. James. You spoke of record profits or robust profits there at Amtrak. Not sure that's a term that's wildly popular on college campuses nowadays, but I appreciate your candor and the fact that the company is doing well. My question is more in regards to the subsidy argument. You know, you talked a little bit about a subsidy-free situation that you had in one example. How likely do you think that is for this project, maybe either out the gates or down the road? We heard testimony earlier that it seemed like a for sure thing that there would be some sort of a rider subsidy. There was a 2010 state rail plan study that was done, and it came back at about, for a round trip, about $168 per rider. That's at a $1 billion cost. I think the numbers have changed a little bit since then, but assuming a $1 billion cost for the project, we're at roughly $168 per rider as a projected subsidy. And so obviously the taxpayers would bear that burden, not to get argumentative, but I mean, essentially Amtrak would still end up profitable in a situation like that. And so, I appreciate you spouting the efforts of Amtrak and doing well. I think that that's important, but it's also important, I think, to recognize that not all situations end up in a subsidy-free environment. So if you could just maybe take a second to address that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. James.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. No, that's a very good question. When I referenced the 3.3, that would be the actual revenue that we bring in. That does not cover it's only in this year do we anticipate that $3.3 billion revenue earned by Amtrak will actually equal the actual cost of running the system. So it won't be a profit. It'll just be a break-even situation. And granted, we consider operating contracts when we run state-supported services to be revenue by Amtrak. We wouldn't be running the service except if the state decided to come to us. My understanding is the reference to the $1 billion cost of the NLX project was a previous iteration of the project that called for much higher speeds and many more frequencies, so the cost would have been much greater. I've actually been involved with the NLX folks and the organizers since I started my time at Amtrak, and my understanding is that the current iteration is for 4 round trips at 90 miles per hour. So that would bring the cost down because it doesn't cost as much money to make the trains go that fast. So it brings down the operating loss as well. Based upon the NLX analysis, my understanding is that the annual operating subsidy for the service would be about $17 million. We haven't done our own analysis on that. We have to go based on theirs. Once negotiations are, let's say, more robust, that the state has decided to step forward, that there looks like there's a real interest by the state to do this project, we will get down into the nitty-gritty and, not a technical term, I guess, to determine what the operating costs will be, how much we expect to come from fares, how much the taxpayers would contribute. Most of the states or that we contract with around the country do subsidize their local passenger train operations. The state of California, again, an outlier to the tune of $120 million. The state of Texas, we have a contract for $1.5 million. It really depends on, it's a local decision, a state decision, whether or not you think those taxpayer investments are worth the service that you get. So yes, a subsidy would be required. But a subsidy is required for local transit, subsidy is required for a number of things. It's up to you guys to make the decision whether or not that makes sense for the state. So, in fairness, yeah.
Yeah, thank you for pointing that out, Mr. James. I think we subsidize roads, we subsidize bridges, we even subsidize air travel. Mm-hmm. So every form of transportation has a subsidy in one form or another, from one public entity or another. So thank you.
Mr. Chairman, yes, can I clear up one thing here?
You heard
from Mr. Bueller a little bit earlier about our fare box recovery. Our fare box recovery will be in the 75% range. Our operating cost will be about $17 million per year. Our subsidy we're projecting at $5 to $6 million a year. So that's just want to clear up.
So in other words, a significant change since the report that was quoted. Let's have Representative Petersburg. I'll have a quick question, and then we need to move on so we can get all of our public testimony in before we need to leave. So Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. James, for seeing you again. I saw you down at the Winona Depot spot there, which is another cold day, if I remember right. But thank you for being here. So earlier we heard that there are three primary players in this NLX project. It's the state, in regards to both the capital improvements as well, or investment, as well as the subsidy. The other one is U.S. Amtrak participants. And the third one is BNSF, that they're not on the testimony list here. And so the question that I have is they're owners of the track, and I'm guessing without them, we're kind of null and void here as well as that. Have you had any, Amtrak had any discussions with them as to far as their availability or ability to actually go into negotiations and so forth? Because I think that's one of the critical pieces that we need here.
Excellent question. Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Mr. James.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Mr. Chairman, we actually have an ongoing, very robust dialogue with BNSF, not just on this service, but we operate probably about 20% of our route network is on BNSF. So we have an operating contract with them that governs our access to their railroad. They do know, and I, my understanding, have been engaged with the NLX planners for this service. We have had some discussions with them so that they know this is a possibility. And as was indicated before, our creation gave us access rights to every stretch of railroad in America, negotiated access. We already have an operating agreement with BNSF, so this would just be folded into the existing operating agreement. We actually have a very good relationship with BNSF. They are one of our best railroads in terms of dispatching and handling Amtrak trains.
President Petersburg, quick follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just a quick follow-up. So it sounds like the negotiations that you have with them, regardless of whether or not this particular piece of the track, BNSF would like to eliminate your service or not, you still have an agreement to have access to this. So it's kind of a situation where they don't have an awful lot of choice. Is that your opinion?
Mr. James.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Peter, Representative Petersburg. Gosh, I wouldn't like to frame it as not having much choice. I have, in my dealings with the passenger rail representatives at BNSF, BNSF has categorized their operations of Amtrak trains on their network as being a key indicator of their network's performance. If you go to their dispatching center in Fort Worth, Texas, which is a pretty high-tech, amazing facility, up on the main dispatching screens, it lists and sort of lists the status of all the Amtrak trains and commuter trains, because they run a lot of commuter trains in addition to NLX. It lists them up on their screen and how those trains are doing. So I guess you could categorize it as no, they don't have a choice, but we pay them incentive payments to run our trains well, and they treat our trains fairly well. I hope that answers your question.
I have one last quick question, and that is, I know that we've had some members in the East Metro in Minneapolis-St. Paul concerned that this doesn't go to St. Paul. And so my question is, I've always wondered about that spur that, you know, connects the two cities. I know the current Amtrak train runs on that going northwest out of St. Paul. What has there been any discussion or conversation about the ability to utilize existing connections between the two cities on a freight rail network, both for this and I would imagine even for North Star, so that St. Paul would have service? What is the status of that? Has that been discussed or studied?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, it has been studied. It was studied initially with the NLX project going directly to St. Paul. As you know, a good part of the railroad was removed between St. Paul and north of Forest Lake. The cost of reinstalling that rail line and then the ridership numbers didn't make sense to rebuild that rail line. It made more sense and more effective to go to Minneapolis. The direct connection between Minneapolis and St. Paul, freight-wise, has been studied on a couple of occasions, one related to this project, the NLX project, was conducted by MnDOT. Mr. Letterly, again, is here with me. He was involved with that study. I don't have the exact numbers on it, but I think there is a potential for doing that. And then we also looked at the potential of Amtrak or another provider use the freight rail line and then make connections to NLX either at Fridley, was a possibility of making that connection too, or from time to time, rather, NLX going into Minneapolis, take the freight line over to St. Paul. So those things have been looked at. I think there's the possibilities there to do that. I just don't know how far along it is in that evaluation and whether or not that would be a project in itself. But Frank could answer that better than I can.
Well, that's good. I can pursue that separately. We're in the interest of time, I think we should move on. Mm-hmm. But I'll definitely talk to Mindot more about that. Mm-hmm. So we do appreciate your testimony and the committee's questions. And members of the committee and the public, I we'll go a little past four just because I want to make sure that all of the people that signed up as public testifiers have an opportunity to testify. But and we have just a few more. I'd like to call on St. Louis County Commissioners Boyle and Nelson. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Patrick Boyle, St. Louis County Commissioner and Chair for a few more weeks, and then I'll give it up and I give anybody credit that chairs any board. It's tough work. I want to thank you all for coming here tonight. December, 10 below, black ice the whole way. That's how it rolls in Duluth this time of year. So thank you for all making. I also want to thank the authors of the bills, Olson and Murphy, for their continued work. Representative Schultz have heard endless work done in St. Paul fighting for us. Just a little bit to talk about here. Commissioner Nelson was not able to make it down here due to weather, but we were both able to go down to D.C. At the end of October to lobby for NLX. And I know that Representative Schultz just basically proved that the need what is for the millennials and their demand for public transportation moving forward for the future. But I also want to talk a little bit about another very important group, and I know you have this this literature, the numbers of veterans by county. And off of our rail line, per capita, we have one of the biggest veteran populations in the country. With a satellite clinic in Superior, Wisconsin, and a veterans nursing home in Silver Bay, we are finding it extremely difficult to find rides to those vets that need the help and care down at the main clinic, the main hospital in Minneapolis. This will absolutely take over a need for our veterans, and we look forward to proving this in the future to you again. But that's just a significant part we want to talk to you about. The last thing is, you've heard from so many folks, the moons have aligned. We finally have support from two governors, from two Department of Transportations in two states, from both mayors of Superior Duluth. This is a project that is going to work. It was the vision of then on the federal side, Representative Murphy gave you on the state, but the federal side was the late great Congressman James Oberstar and Dave Obey in the Wisconsin side that came up with this. And we just had some really good meetings down in D.C. regarding this, especially in the offices of Senator Tina Smith, Senator Tammy Baldwin in Wisconsin, and our Congressman Pete Stauber from our area. It is with no doubt that if we start the ball rolling, if we get some money from the state of Minnesota, incorporate that in with the feds, the dominoes will fall. And we look forward to that help to give that fight down in St. Paul to you moving forward in 2020. But that is our year. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Commissioner. Any quick questions for Commissioner Boyle and Chair Boyle for another few weeks?
2 weeks. I'm not coming down.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. The next testifier is Phil Kester from Sandstone. Is Phil here? He'll be coming up with Leonard Bonander also. Yep. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
I'm Phil Kester from Sandstone Village Council.
Welcome.
My name is Leonard Bonander, Sandstone resident. I was a city councilor for 11 years. I'm just going to tell you what kind of impact this kind of project would have on a small town. I'm from the western suburbs of Minneapolis, spent most of my life there. I had traveled a lot, traveled throughout the whole country, every major city I've been to numerous times. I ended up moving to Sandstone like 15 years ago. I moved to town. Somebody says, well, why don't you run for city council? So I said, okay, so I ran and then I won. And there I am. And now I'm sitting in a room with four other councilors and a city administrator. And I'm looking at a town that needed a lot of help. So I'm thinking the team in this room, five city councilors and a city administrator, we have to help transform, change our little town. So how are we going to do that? Big question. So then we were facing the challenge of possibly having our hospital close. So we worked really hard to save that, and we kept that, and we got a new facility out of that. And the only reason only way we were able to do that was with help from our state and federal elected officials. Without their help, we would never have gotten there. So we're a little teeny town of 1,550 unincarcerated people, because we have a prison in our town. And for living wage jobs, we don't have a whole lot in our area. You have to go to either the Twin Ports or the Twin Cities, generally an hour plus drive, commute, good weather, etc. So when we were looking at how we were going to create a future for our little town, we're having our core job institution being a hospital facing closure, and we have a federal prison, and that's about it for the major employers. So to keep our hospital, we built a office park, a business park, a couple hundred acres, but then there was a waterway there, so we needed to cross that waterway. So we went to the bonding committee and said, hey, we need $300,000 to put in some culverts so we could build a road so we can get our hospital project done. And you know what? We got the $300,000. Then we found out the next year that since it was a new waterway crossing, we needed a dozen new permits, and it was going to take over another year of review to see if they'll let us put a culvert. So we had to go for a bridge. So now we need $1.3 million for a bridge. And we went to the Minnesota House Bonding Committee and said, guess what? We're back. We need some more money. And, you know, we got the money. And like help from like Mr. Torkelson, he helped us get that money. And that helped our little teeny town. And I'm glad to hear that you really like trains. I was kind of worried there. But I'm going to get to the point very, very shortly. I'm not taking a long time. But, you know, the only way little towns that are struggling like Sandstone, that are positioned right for growth, the only way they're going to get ahead is with, like, your help. So, you know, one of the best ways you can spur development is with transportation, as you all know. I mean, I remember going to the University of Minnesota, driving down University Avenue, and it was busy all the way to St. Paul. All the little shops were all full. Then I remember driving down, like, a dozen years ago, and it was, like, empty. And I'm thinking, what's going on here? The whole neighborhood's all closed. Then they talked about light rail. And then in anticipation of light rail, I drive down the University Avenue, there's all these apartment buildings growing up, just building like crazy, just in the anticipation of a project happening like that. So I've traveled the United States and went to every major city there was. I've been to Washington, D.C. You know, they have the metro there, the blue line, the green line, the red line, the orange line. Can you imagine that city today operating, functioning without that system? So every other major city that I've gone to in the United States, they all have a rail system, either light rail or a heavy rail going out of town. And if you look at the population projections for Minneapolis, St. Paul, it's going to boom. Where are they going to put all these cars? How are you going to move all these people? How are you going to get people to work and back? So I live in Sandstone. not much job opportunity. We've been mentioned as a possible maintenance facility site, possible layover facility site. I mean, we would be happy if we had some kind of platform and had a flag stop and at least get connected up to the rest of the world.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So thank you. Our next is Mr. Kester. Are you going to say anything? Okay. Good.
Right on.
You could, okay.
Thank you for thank this you. Opportunity.
Thank you very much. So our next person is Cal Randa. Is Cal here? You know, I'll actually say that so people can get ready and we can move things along. Diane Saunders would be next after Cal.
Hello, and thank you, Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you very much. One second here. So my name is Cal Randa, and I just wanted to speak briefly about how I think this project would impact the public and its overall importance. A lot has already been said by my representatives that I'm very grateful for, and I guess it's just kind of a, you know, a younger person's public perspective on how this would, you know, work. What immediately comes to mind to friends and family that I've told about this project is that, you know, it's, so wait, there would be a way for me to travel around the state between Duluth and the cities without worrying about whether a car can make the trip, without stopping and paying for a full tank of gas or worrying about the road or weather, you know, obviously in a tone of support. And so for my friends here in Duluth, it would mean they'd be able to go to the cities for various cultural events, conventions, or anything else that hasn't quite made it up to Duluth yet. For my friends in the cities, it means they'd be able to, well, get out of the city. They'd be able to travel up north and see some of the more, you know, the bountiful nature we have up here and participate in outdoor activities. When I was in sixth grade, my science teacher, Mr. Juttenin, told me about how the future of the area was going to be people taking trains everywhere, especially for their jobs. Well, I don't think that will necessarily be the case because I think Duluth has a lot of, you know, way to grow in terms of job growth and opportunities. I do think that the interconnectedness of the state's economy will continue to grow and the interdependency of it. Each part of the state will rely more and more on each other for their support. And given this, the need for reliable mass transit options will only grow. Not to mention the need for travel options that don't require you to pour ever more money into the gas tank. So this isn't to say, I know there's a lot of people that are worried about the cost of the project on the taxpayers, but as kind of Mary, or Representative Murphy, sorry, had said before, it's this is a project that's an investment in the future. It will allow us to more easily step into the economic demands of tomorrow, and more personally, it will allow each of us to explore a lot of what the state has to offer in a much easier state and with a lot less worry. So
thank you
very much for this opportunity.
Thank you for your testimony. It's Diane Saunders here. Oh, okay. Welcome. And then Phil Qualley is next. And I would just ask again, in the interest of time, if folks could keep their testimony about 3 minutes or less, then we can end just a little bit later than scheduled. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Hornstein, and the ranking member and committing members. My name is Diane Saunders, and I do live in Duluth. I have 3 points that I would like to talk about this project. Number one, and I seem to be in a minority here, but I think this is the wrong solution to the region's mobility needs. This project was outdated and obsolete the day it was finalized in terms of its design. It relies on 1900s technology, diesel electric locomotives, to solve a 21st century problem. Any project built will need to last at least 30 years. Duluth and the Twin Cities need to be better connected through the use of 21st century technology, and this is not 21st century technology. Connecting people through seamless mobility will enhance, not detract, from the goals of we have for the future up here. The project needs to be rethought so that it is based on proven 21st century technologies such as a rail solution that truly does provide for higher speeds than is currently available through the use of diesel-powered locomotives and steel passenger cars, which, by the way, are horribly inefficient in terms of their energy use. Today's electrified passenger rail is at least 75% more efficient. That means lower operating costs. There needs to be electrified rolling stock powered by an overhead catenary, dual class 6 tracks that are dedicated to passenger use only. They must be grade separated, and the signaling technology to make it safe is what's required for this solution. Positive train control has not yet been implemented in the United States. The rail lines have continued to ask for it to be pushed back, and it has been pushed back, and there's no foreseeable future for when it will be implemented. A better solution is ERTMS, the European standard, that is rapidly becoming the international standard in terms of signaling technology. Why reinvent the wheel when someone else has proven technology that can be used here? Point number two, the current project's estimated speeds of, I said 690 to 95, but even that's changed now to 60 to 90, is a waste of everybody's time. Current speeds on I-35 run between 80 to 85 miles per hour on a road that's posted as 70. There simply is no incentive to take this train when one can get to the city of Duluth or the city of Minneapolis in about the same time by driving there. The whole incentive is to get people off of the roads and onto the train, and this won't do that. My final point is that we need a true modern-day rail solution, not some nostalgic train from the past. This is the 21st century, and we need to act like it. I urge you not to fund this project, as I predict it will fail in 10 years if you fund it, because there's just no incentive to write it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Qualley, welcome to the committee. And after Mr. Qualley, Deb DeLuca.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, good evening. It's Philip Qualley, State Director for the United Transportation Union Smart Transportation Division. It's great to see you here in the Zenith City at the base of the Arrowhead. And on behalf, I'm joined here today by other railroad workers from the CN and BNSF Railway, and we thank you for hearing railroad workers today and members of the AFL-CIO. First of all, we certainly support House File 387 and the Grassy Point proposal legislation as well. I would respectfully ask you to take a look at our handout, if you would, please. You will see our cover letter with the DFM Group survey, public survey, which I would, is an abstracted portion. And I simply want to point out that we can provide the complete survey upon request, but this was 555 cell and landlines across Minnesota in March of 2019. And question 7B, when Minnesotans asked across the state, would you support regional rail transportation service, 73% of Minnesotans would support that. And again, there's interesting data in that survey, which also had to do with rail safety. I'd also like to point out in our handout is information from the Midwest Interstate Passenger Rail Commission, of which we are partners. SMART-TD is a partner, and I simply put in some of that data so that you can see the level of federal grants that are being issued to other Midwest cities and passenger rail corridors and improving their economies. I would just like to speak very quickly on a couple of operating pieces. Briefly, BNSF has historically been a very good host railroad. Secondly, it's very important for the city of Duluth and our state economy to consider that any track improvements not only benefit the passenger service, but the freight and intermodal service. Very, very important when you have an international port to have a stronger intermodal service and freight service. That's a twofer with this proposed legislation. Currently, our conductors on the BNSF are federally certified, qualified, and ready to run NLX now if need be. Our guys are ready to run railroads if the equipment is provided. And then finally, you know, I've heard comments about the speed of 90 miles per hour and so on. I have to say that the importance of having well-trained and certified conductors and train crews and get the public on and off trains efficiently and safely is really very, very important to the operation of a railroad. I just want to close by saying that as the train crews who operate the railroads across the United States, really, we need to emphasize to the Transportation Committee respectfully that the world is our country is building out state corridor services, and for the future of our state's economy, our competition in the world marketplace, as well as the nation marketplace, we really should be building out these integrated commuter and state corridor service. I'll just close by simply saying, you know, not only is there NLX investment would create many, many, many jobs that would be a magnet from all over the state for workers, as we saw with the recent building of the stadium in Minneapolis. This will attract workers building the railroad from all over the state and Wisconsin. And then finally, but the long-term benefit to our region economy, for veterans, for business commuters, for the arts communities, college students, and the opportunities for marketing for the tourism is really huge. So thank you for hearing the railroad workers today.
Thank you, Mr. Qualley. Deb DeLuca. I just send Deb as a brief PowerPoint, is that correct?
I do, but I can skip the PowerPoint in the interest of time. I do have folders that are being passed out.
Yeah, I mean, we would be interested if it could be passed out and we can follow your presentation. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives. I'm here today, so this is, you'll notice I'm under, I think it's Roman numeral 5, so new topic. I'm here to talk about freight, and specifically I'm here to talk about the Duluth Seaway Port Authority's Clear Public Marine Terminal. This is a multimodal logistics hub. It is, it seamlessly blends rail, track, and maritime modes, and we do seamlessly move between those modes. We own and maintain the assets of the Clear Public Marine Terminal, and our agent, we have an operating agent through an operating agent agreement, Lake Superior Warehousing. They've been our agent since 1991. They operate those assets on our behalf, and together we market those that combined partnership of the Duluth Seaway Port Authority and Lake Superior Warehousing as Duluth Cargo Connect. So you see that name out and about. That's what it's referring to. We operate these assets as with a goal of providing supply chain cost savings to our regional industries to keep them competitive in the global marketplace, and to open new trade lanes and markets to them. And I'm hoping to give you a couple of examples. We've had a big year. I do want to mention that this is one of 20 active terminals in the port. We advocate for the rest of those terminals, but today I'm talking just about the Clear Public Marine Terminal. We are the largest port in the Great Lakes, as you all know, by tonnage. And it still is an economic driver for the region, and there's an economic impact statement in your packet to that effect. Our port is served by four Class 1 railroads, BNSF amongst them, this means very competitive rail rates for the region, but we are also served by all four of those Class 1 railroads right at our terminal, and that means very competitive rail rates right at our terminal. So that really feeds very much into our business model. I'm going to talk to you about the three primary freight service areas that we serve, and I'm going to start with maritime. In terms of maritime, we are the one project cargo terminal in the harbor. Project cargo and heavy lift cargo terminal. So this is, as Dwayne mentioned, this is the one location in the harbor where you can see these big pieces of equipment that are lifted with cranes or forklifts. So we serve the manufacturing, mining, petroleum, forest product, power generation, wind energy, all those industries. That maritime, it's a beautiful thing to see. There was a ship that was just unloaded yesterday. We were hoping you could stop by the terminal and see some of this in person, but that's why you have the pictures in your packet. Anyway, we have 40 acres of outdoor laydown space, and that is really supports that maritime piece, because these pieces are big. They don't get stored inside, right? And I also want to mention these are those oversized, overweight loads that Dwayne mentioned. We had 600 of those loads go off of our terminal this year, and there are other manufacturers in the region, and even right on Rice's Point, that that generate those oversized, overweight loads. The only way they can get onto that, access that Twin Ports interchange when they're completed, is to have those 535 ramps complete. The MnDOT was very conscientious in designing that Twin Ports interchange with bridge clearances and turn radii that accommodate those huge pieces of cargo, but they can't get onto the Twin Ports interchange unless the ramps are completed. So we'll be working with Dwayne's group at MnDOT to help get those funded. I have to mention, in the maritime area, we had a huge, we had actually a record-breaking wind cargo season. We had 306,000 freight tons. It's a new record for us. Again, every single square inch of open laydown area was covered at our terminal this summer. The maritime I covered. The next is our warehousing service sector. The warehousing really services our truck and rail business. And that truck and rail business, and again, this is where you really see the advantage of the competitive rail rates. So our regional industries, what you'll see is that they will train, by train they'll move goods to our warehouse, we store it for them in inventory, and then it goes on a just-in-time basis by truck, so they can take advantage of the competitive rail rates to get, say, raw materials, and we're stored at our warehouse, goes out in just-in-time basis to the manufacturing centers, and then the reverse is true, so that the finished product is trucked to us, stored there before it goes out for the point of sale, stored at our warehouses. The warehouses are, we have 430,000 square feet of warehouse space, and if you go in there, you'd see OSB board, pulp, finished wood, finished lumber, paper rolls, lots and lots of pulp, and more. This warehouse space also serves our third service area, which is the intermodal terminal. Someone here mentioned intermodal terminals and the importance of it. This is the movement of, when you hear intermodal in rail speak, that means containers. So this is the one intermodal terminal outside of the Twin Cities. It's located on the Kluwer Public Marine Terminal. Right now it's just road and rail, and that's excellent. If you look at, there's a map in your packet that shows why we are partnered with Canadian National in this endeavor. We're right smack dab in the middle of their network, and we access all three coasts, Gulf, Pacific, and Atlantic, six ports on those coasts. And what's really, really probably most key for our regional industries is the first time we have access to Asia, first time we have an Asian play. So what this means, again, remember I mentioned that we are always seeking to provide supply chain cost savings to our regional industries. Companies that never exported before are now exporting. There's some right here in town. We've opened up new trade lanes and new markets for them. Companies report saving up to a third on their freight costs because they don't need to get their goods to either the Twin Cities or Chicago to move west. All of our containers move across the Grassy Point Bridge. And when that bridge was down for 3 weeks this summer, we felt it. In the freight world, reliability is everything. Really appreciate that the legislation that Representative Olson is bringing forward. I understand, and I haven't seen it yet, but thank you very much for that. So that's what's been happening in our realm. I have to put a plug in for MnDOT's Port Development Assistance Grant Program. We're in a growth mode. That we're trying to take advantage of that intermodal terminal, making sure it grows correctly. We're hitting all of our key performance indicators. We've expanded the intermodal terminal. We've poured $25 million into that terminal since 2015, the entire terminal. About $4.9 million of that comes from the Port Development Assistance Grant Program. Whether we're growing or we're replacing our 60-year-old infrastructure, we have a whole city of infrastructure to maintain. So we really appreciate the funds that have come our way through the Port Development Assistance Grant Program. We feel we put them to good use. They require a 20% match, but we consistently outmatch that. We are usually contributing 60% of the funds, PDAPs 40%. So, and increasingly, we're using that state funds to leverage federal funds. So, this is also true of our sister ports in Red Wing, Winona, yeah, and St. Paul. And so I have to put a plug in for them. They have similar great stories with their aging infrastructure. But that's it, and I'd take any questions. Oh, one other thing. We were awarded, we were recognized as Port Terminal Operator of the Year by Heavy Lift and Project Forwarding International as an international award, which is really kind of amazing for a port that's 2,340 miles inland from the Atlantic Ocean. But I think it's a testament to the quality of the work we do and the infrastructure that we have.
Well, thank you, Ms. DeLuca, and congratulations on the award. I want to see again, I think the port is important enough, and that we spend just a tiny bit more time. If people have questions, we can take those now. Well, thank you very much. Go ahead.
No, thank you. I should thank we have House File 432 and House File 433 left over from last year. The first of those is $5 million in general funds, and the second of those is $10 million in GO bonds. For the PDAP program, and I have to say thank you to the authors. Several of them are here, and anyway, thank you.
Great. Well, thank you, and ports are sometimes an overlooked but extremely important part of our work here, and I'm so glad that you mentioned Winona, Red Wing, St. Paul. There's, of course, private ports that we are engaged with, too, and Savage and other locations, but this is really important, and I appreciate your testimony and coming today.
Well, thank you very much.
Members, we have, several more, six, seven more people, and I'll just call the names. If I haven't called your name and you would like to testify, definitely talk to Mr. Howe now. I have Matt Hamila, Mr. Trunt, Mr. Blake, Mr. Pumphrey, Mr. Pearson, and Mr. Davis on the list. And if I haven't called your name, please get on the list with Mr. Howe. And again, we appreciate that, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Matt Hamila.
Hamila,
yep. Yeah. Good finish name. Deputy Public Works Director for St. Louis County for Engineering and Program Delivery. And I'm here to talk about a few funding sources that the local agencies rely on heavily for the road and bridge systems throughout the state of Minnesota. The local agencies, as I'm sure you've heard before, own 3/4 of the bridges in the state, 15,200 plus, 1,000 of which are structurally deficient right now, and about 1/3 of the roads at 45,000 miles. So. Everybody already, I'm sure, on the transportation committee has heard the value of the local transportation system as the collector to get commerce and residents to the trunk highway system, get everybody where they're going. So these funding sources I'm going to go through are all requesting funds this year, mostly bonding. You'll hear from them from MICA and other organizations. But we wanted to give a plug for them. The first one is the local bridge replacement program. A lot of local agencies, townships, cities, counties are relying on that program to replace most of their bridges. Without the funding source, a lot of the bridges would be load posted or load posted more than they are down to a lower level or closed altogether. Right now, there is a waiting list with 80 bridges on it. Those bridges are shovel ready. They're ready to go. Plans are signed. They're waiting down with state aid. The immediate need of those 80 bridges is $42 million. So if the program was funded with $42 million today, it would be eaten up immediately. Additionally, that $42 million leverages another $49 million in other sources. So those projects are all ready to go, and it would help out the economy and those bridges. Those 1,000 bridges, of course, that number is always growing every year. Funding for the program has been pretty unpredictable over the years, which is tough for planning. A lot of the recent funding that's been allocated to bridge bonding has been eaten up with large earmarks with metro projects that are, big and worthy, but it didn't leave a lot for the locals to get their projects done. So St. Louis County is in support of the $100 million recommendation from MICA and others that are requesting for the funding of that program this year. The second program is called the Local Road Improvement Program, or LRIP. It's kind of the same type of program, funded primarily with bonding dollars, but it's instead of bridges, it's with roads. And it's a pretty vital funding source for the locals, specifically for trunk highway projects with a local percentage. A good example of that is if the trunk highway was doing a signal replacement project, and it was a trunk highway county-county intersection with four legs, the county or the city would be responsible for half of the project cost with that. And so LRIP is a great funding source for supplying them with those types of funds to keep the trunk highway projects moving and help out the locals so they don't have to have budget busters in their own programs. It's also used a lot for local share federal match on federal funded projects. And it's also contributes to large local projects to bring that cost down for the locals. So that one also has been inconsistently funded, makes planning difficult, and we'd like to support the request that's in for that for $100 million. The third one is probably the most crucial. It's the Local Road Wetland Replacement Program, and I'm sure you've heard of this problem. On the locals, whenever we do a project that has wetlands impacted, since 96, they've had a program run by Bowser, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, that provides the mitigation credits to the local agencies so they don't have to go out and buy them on the open market. And the state's divided up into 10 bank service areas, depending on watersheds. And currently, four of those bank service areas have zero credits available for the locals. And I think by the end of 2020, excuse me, they figure that all of them will be at or near zero. They'll be borrowing from each other, I think, in 2020 to keep some projects going, but I think there are 2020 projects that probably are at risk of not having credits to use from the bank that would require them to go either to the open market to get those credits, or they would delay or cancel the project altogether. Bowser typically creates wetlands or puts wetlands in conservation to create those credits, but it is a four-year process, so even if they had the money today, creating them is probably not going to get us out of the pickle, so they'll probably need a cash allotment or something to be able to buy some to supplement what the bank service areas that are low on credits today.
Mr. Hemel, if you could wrap up shortly.
I got one more.
That would help.
My favorite one.
Okay.
So St. Louis County, in 2018, the feds put out a new funding program for bridges. It was called the Competitive Highway Bridge Program, where they took applications, three from every state that had lower population densities. They had $225 million to give away. And the concept of it was federal bridge bundling, essentially what it converts to. St. Louis County and MnDOT collaboratively did an application. It was ranked number one in Minnesota. Was sent in. We were funded. The project in total for engineering and construction was $17.6 million to replace 17 St. Louis County bridges and four MnDOT bridges. They would be done under two construction contracts. We estimated they would save 15 to 20% if they were done individually. We were lucky enough to get chosen, but we only got 10 of the $14 million in federal money that we requested. So we got a $4 million funding gap plus the 3.5 local match. So we're going to be looking for bonding or other to cover that $4 million gap so we can leverage that $10.2 million in years 22 and 23. So that is all I got. And
well, thank you. Are there questions? We appreciate the partnership with counties. You know, we had a tour when we were in the Winona mini session and, you know, got a real sense of, you know, the big gap between your needs and available funding. And I think that you have been
incredible with what you've been able to accomplish with limited resources. And so I appreciate that. And again, we're going to continue to try to get new revenue on the table and make your difficult work a little easier. we tried last session, but weren't able to get it across the finish line. But we do, again, appreciate the counties have just been amazing, and we appreciate your work so much.
Thank you. One little safety tip. When I was on my way in, I parked in that free lot over there, and there was a guy lying on his back on the sidewalk because it was slippery. So be careful. And that guy may have been me. So.
Funny. All right. We have another county board, county representative, Mr. Trunt, Itasca County Commissioner, and he's also the chair of the Western Mesabi Mine Planning Board. So thank you. You've got a lot of hats on.
Yes, thank you,
Mr. Chair. We appreciate your being here.
Thank you. I appreciate that, and I appreciate the members listening to our testimony. We really do appreciate you coming out to Greater Minnesota, so that's very good. Yes, the Western Mesabi Mine Planning Board is a joint powers board made up of cities and townships in the western part of the Mesabi, as well as Itasca County, basically ranging from the city of Grand Rapids to the city of Keewatin and the townships and cities in between. We are a committee that came together a number of years ago, actually about 25 years now, and we represent that area in trying to promote mining as well as transportation and other issues that affect our area. The House Incentive Bills in February of 2019 requested that upgrading of the remaining 8 miles of the Cross Range Expressway from 2 lanes to 4 lanes be included in MnDOT's 10-year capital investment program. However, this request had not made it into the final bill. It is estimated that approximately $15 million will be needed for pre-planning and route confirmation, land acquisition, permitting, and preliminary engineering to make that road, that portion of it, shovel-ready for construction, which we estimate may take up to $90 million. Members, the Highway 169 is the only major highway that connects the communities from Grand Rapids to Virginia. There are no reasonable alternative routes. You know, the Cross Range Expressway was started in the 1950s, and we've been working on it for a long time. We've been trying to be very patient, but we are persistent in the need for transportation, as are other parts of the state. The main artery still has 8 miles of two-lane highway between the cities of Taconite and Nashwauk. These are sandwiched between the major segments of the four-lane highways, a four-lane highway from Grand Rapids to Taconite, and then continuing from basically Nashwauk to Virginia. So you can see the restriction that we have there. It's a difficult stretch of highway, but one that needs to be taken care of. There have been a number of accidents and fatalities in this area, and we just want to try to make some progress on that. While there have been two short sections of 169 improved in the last 15 years, of which we are grateful, the rest is still a two-lane highway that is narrow, lacks full shoulders, has deteriorated pavement that needs frequent repairs, and has numerous hills and tight curves and poses restrictions and safety hazards for commercial traffic and passenger automobiles. The remaining 8 miles poses safety concerns and are an economic constraint under the current conditions and will pose even larger concerns and constraints with economic plans come together. We are talking about such plans as Mesabi Metallics, the former SR project, as well as reconstituting the magnetation projects and trying to improve mining projects of that part of the Mesabi range. Because land acquisition, permitting, preliminary design and funding requirements all require substantial time, highway construction can lag behind these projects and impact our economic projects. We believe that substantial upgrading of the remaining 2 miles of the Cross Range Expressway between Taconite and Pingilly should be given a high priority for the $15 million appropriation funding to include pre-planning for the remaining 8 miles, the land acquisition, the permitting, and the environmental reviews that need to take place. Full construction funding of approximately $90 million of bond funding for the four-lane highway is also being requested as we can eventually make this a shovel-ready project. Members, I certainly appreciate your attendance and listening to my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Trent. And I believe that Representative Sandstedt has been very involved in this issue, and I've had conversations with her. I know the commissioner as well has been engaged with this, and
There's definitely, I think, safety and economic development arguments to be made for this project. So thank you for sharing your testimony. Are there any questions, members?
Any questions? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, our next testifier is Rick Blake from the Grand Rapids City Council, home of Lauren Solberg.
Yes. Right.
That's right. And members, it's again important. We have a lot of local partners, and you know the League of Cities has been very engaged with us, and so we'll get a little bit of an overview of local concerns up in this region. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rick Blake, and I'm a city councilor for the city of Grand Rapids, a community of just over 11,000 people in Itasca County. And I also would like to say that I can join Representatives Murphy, Nelson, Mason, and Mayor Larson as a veteran of the North Star Line.
Okay.
I also rode a passenger train from Grand Rapids to Cohasset. Probably nobody else can say that.
Wow.
But that's not why I'm here. As a city of over 5,000, we receive municipal street aid from the state. However, just like cities of all sizes across Minnesota, we're having trouble keeping up with our street repair. City streets are important to us. We all benefit from the mobility they provide. Even if we walk to the grocery store, the grocer still relies on streets to transport the goods he provides for us. The same goes for stores who sell us the clothes we wear, the building materials we use to build and maintain our homes, businesses, and factories. Our streets serve our city and its economy in the same way our blood vessels serve our body, providing the conduit that delivers what we need to thrive. I think the vast majority of us understand this. As a city councilor, I feel responsible for the condition of our city streets, and I'm not proud of their condition. The greatest long-term threat to the city budget is funding our city streets. As you can see from the handout, Grand Rapids owns and maintains 93 miles of streets. On average, a street needs improvement, that is construction or overlay, every 30 years. Therefore, in order to maintain a good street network, a prudent plan would require about 3 miles of street improvement per year. The current estimate provided by our city engineer is that the cost per foot of a city street and storm sewer reconstruction is about $600, which works out to about $3 million a mile. In order to carry out our prudent plan, we would need to average at least $3 million and up to $9 million a year for street maintenance, depending on what proportion is reconstructed or overlaid. For the past 9 years, including our 2020 plan, we've been able to maintain just under 1.4 miles per year. For the past 5 years, that average has dropped to 3/4 of a mile. We simply can't afford the level of levy increases required to maintain our streets. Currently, 30% of our levy, or $1.7 million, goes to pay debt service on the streets we've improved. If unchecked, this debt will weigh heavier and heavier on our city's taxpayers, both businesses and residents. The Minnesota state government's response to infrastructure maintenance has been woefully inadequate. The legislature has been unable to provide even marginally adequate revenue for city streets and has been unwilling to give us the tools we need, for example, the sales tax authority, to handle it more effectively at a local level. The problem is so great that it will remain a problem no matter how successful we are at attracting new businesses and industries. We need to find a way to maintain our streets without increasing our debt and wasting money on interest payments. We need a dedicated and sustainable source of funds to maintain our city streets. Even though almost everyone understands the importance of our streets, we struggle to come up with a fair way of paying for them. Here in Duluth, the voters overwhelmingly approved a sales tax for their city streets. Our efforts to do the same have come up short, but street maintenance remains one of the top issues we hear about from constituents. Something must be done. The cost of maintaining our city streets has risen much faster than our ability to pay, whether through property taxes, local government aid, or municipal street aid. We have supported creating a street improvement districts, but the legislature has not granted us that power. Again, the cost of properly maintaining city streets is the single greatest threat to the financial health of our community. I know you are interested in getting feedback from Greater Minnesota. and I appreciate your being here, and that's why you are here today. Our feedback is to ask you to come up with a dedicated and sustainable source of funding for our city streets. Finally, I'm aware that the November forecast recently projected the state to have a $1.3 billion surplus. As the debate continues about how to fund our roads, I know that some will turn to the surplus general funds as the answer. I urge you to make more robust, that's a good word today, right? Robust, the constitutionally dedicated resources our state currently uses to fund roads and bridges. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. And I did carry that street improvement district bill at one time. I think that's still a very good source of money. And of course, I think your points are well taken about dedicated sources.
I'll tell Lauren you mentioned his name.
What's that?
I'll tell Lauren you mentioned
yes,
his name.
Yes, okay, I will. All right, thank you. Any questions, members? Okay. We have Mr. Pumphrey and then Mr. Pearson on deck. Thank you for your patience, and we appreciate your work at the Duluth Transit Authority. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Phil Pumphrey. I'm the general manager of the Duluth Transit Authority, and I really have two quick things to say to you on two subjects to talk about real quick. One is on the NLX. The Duluth Transit Authority does 2.7 million trips a year. We serve almost all of Duluth, Proctor and Hermantown and City of Superior. So there's a ready base of public transit available for people to catch the NLX. So we have that, and down in Minneapolis, of course, you have the Metro. And I have a 9-person board of local citizens that govern the DTA. And this year they reaffirmed their support for the NLX because of the benefits that it would provide in economic development to the Duluth area and along the corridor, the access to education and healthcare, the impact on tourism, real estate development, and an environmental benefit by reducing carbon pollution. So my board has endorsed this, and I think that's a great thing. I've worked in the industry of public transit for almost 40 years and been around the country, but this kind of commuter rail has a real benefit to people who don't even use the system. So I'd like you to consider that. Also, the Duluth Transit Authority, we are having a pilot program with 7 electric buses, extended-range buses we're currently operating. And I talked to Liz Olson, Representative Liz Olson, about 2 months ago. I told her, I said, you know, I understand there's been some talk at the legislature about funding for public transit, and it's real important if there's any changes to make sure that it's a dedicated and sustainable change. Because if we don't have a dedicated source and it changes, it causes us to have to reevaluate our service levels, makes it inconvenient for passengers. That's all I have to say today. I want to keep it short because I appreciate you coming up here and I know time is long.
Well, thank you. And I've used the multimodal station or main station there downtown. When was that constructed exactly? It's relatively new, correct?
Yes, sir. The downtown transit center was constructed 3 years ago. It's on Michigan Street. It's in line with the depot. It was constructed for the train to come through, whether it does or not, the NLX.
Yeah.
But it was constructed, and all of our routes but one serve that terminal.
Right. So a lot of the routes come through, and then there's also connection to the Jefferson lines there. So I think, you know, I think it's a model for, you know, Rochester and some of the other, St. Cloud, I think, should all have stations like this. Yeah, I think St. Cloud has something similar, but for a regional center, it's a good model, and I think you've done
it's
well.
It's a well-done effort by the past manager and the board. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Pearson and then Mr. Davis after Mr. Pearson.
Thank you, board, for coming up to Duluth. My name is Chad Pearson. I'm a resident of Duluth, and I'd like to talk about transportation alternatives today. I'm fortunate I live near campus here, that I live in a place where I can walk, bike, bus to get all of my needs. I can bus to the grocery store, walk to work, bike to the library with my children. And again, like I said, I'm really fortunate to do that. I am a board member of the Gitche-Gami Trail Association, which is an advocacy group to the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources to help build the Gitche-Gami State Trail, which is a 89-mile trail from Two Harbors to Grand Marais, which is approximately a third completed right now in four disjoint segments. I'm really glad that MnDOT recently designated the bicycle route between St. Paul and the U.S.-Canada border along the North Shore, U.S. Bike Route 41 or the North Star Route. The problem is, in our region, most of this route exists along the shoulders of Highway 61. If you've driven Highway 61 north of Two Harbors, you know that all but the most diehard bikers are not going to ride that route. The shoulders are too narrow, the traffic is too heavy, especially in the biking season, and it makes that a very limited possibility for most people. This doesn't have to be the case. Minnesota has authorized the Gitche-Gami State Trail, again, to span between the communities of Two Harbors and Grand Marais. This would connect eight communities, five state parks, three scientific and natural areas, and a whole host of businesses, resorts, restaurants in that area. I think this is really providing not a competitive with any other transportations, but a parallel opportunity, especially with the Northern Lights Express, that residents could bring their bike to Duluth and then bike along the North Shore, have very accessible places to get to these communities and these state parks. Right now, that access would probably not exist given the current conditions along Highway 61. And I also just want to advocate for the communities along the North Shore that this trail will connect them in ways that that contribute to the health and well-being and resiliency of the local communities. Right now, the most recent section that was built between Beaver Bay and Silver Bay, we've already seen kids biking to school along this section from Beaver Bay up to Silver Bay. It kicks out right at the high school there, or at the community school there in Silver Bay on top of the hill. There's lots of really great opportunities for this to really connect those communities. We're seeing that already in what's been built. So I just want you guys to think about that, everyone to think about that as they think about transportation along our region. Thank you very much.
And Mr. Pearson, thank you for your testimony. And I guess I appreciate especially your last point. You know, it's really come to this committee's attention, my attention in particular. We have had all around the state a lot more attention being paid not only to bike and pedestrian modes of transportation, but safety issues. You know, you can go around this table here. You know, Representative Cagle has had issues in her district with bike and pedestrian safety. You know, Representative Heinrich on Highway 10, and Representative West. I was just at a meeting in Eagan on this topic. 13-year-old was tragically killed in a bike accident. I was out in the western suburbs a couple of weeks ago, same issue, bike safety and kids. You know, we have the Safe Routes to School program, but it feels like that we need to do some additional thinking and investing in that infrastructure and the safety. So I invite you to be our partner in that effort, and I know we've got a very robust coalition of bike safety advocates around the state, and it's definitely something that I'm hoping our committee can dig a little deeper into in the coming session.
Yes, one more point to that fact. I was hit by a truck last year on my walk to work. I wasn't injured, but I was an inattentive driver. I was in a crosswalk at a four-way stop sign near campus here. But my three daughters walk to a bus stop several blocks away or walk to school in this neighborhood. So safety is always on my mind, and safety yeah. of the whole region. Would really be affected by this trail specifically. So
good. Well, I hope that we'll be in touch, and
thank you.
We'll continue to hear from you. So thank you. So we have three more testifiers, members, Mr. Davis, Ms. Slick, and Mr. Heinrich. So another Mr. Heinrich is. Mr. Davis, welcome, and thanks for traveling such a long distance to be with us.
Good evening. Leslie Davis from Minneapolis. You know, I have a policy that if at first you don't succeed, try 100 more times. So this
and we're passing out your information.
Great. So this is about the 101st time we're doing this plan. But you know, the night before I knew that I was going to come here to do this, it's incredibly stressful because I feel that You're not going to get it again. Something that's the most important piece of legislation economically in the history of the state of Minnesota is not gotten by the legislators. Some of you with terrific education, some of you with not much, some of you with a terrific work experience, don't get it to take this piece of legislation that I'm asking you for, one-liner, added to these thousands of lines. You know, I looked at chapter 48, for example. It talks about banking, preemptive rights and dividends and officers and exclusions and exemptions and all kinds of things, dozens and hundreds of requirements and regulations. And I'm asking for one little line that will be the greatest economic engine ever in the state of Minnesota. And what it will do, it will allow us to build state-of-the-art roads and bridges throughout the state of Minnesota, city, county, state, with no taxing and no borrowing. And second thing that's great that it'll do, it'll allow us to end the vehicle fuel and axle taxes. Terrific things. Put money right in people's pockets. When all these people that they're talking about with AI are not going to be working, they're going to be working in Minnesota because they're going to be building roads and bridges no matter what the time of day. We have the resources, we have the tools, we have the knowledge. The only thing we don't have is the money. So let me just go over a couple of points from the handout that I gave, and I'll be brief because I know late and we're all pretty worn. So how is money created? Mr. Monk of the U.S. Treasury states, and is quoted, nobody has disagreed with this in the decade and more that I've been working on this plan. He says the actual creation of money always involves the extension of credit by private commercial banks. Loans. That's how new money comes into circulation. You go into a bank and you want to buy this motorcycle? Sure. Sign this and they create the money right on the spot. That's how it's done. It's not magic. They've been doing it for a century. He also went on to say that a private commercial bank simply makes entries for its loan customers saying, you have a deposit with us. They do it electronically, and then the money is there. So that's how money is created. Other people, that just confirms on page one that money is created all as loans. There's no tooth fairy, there's no magic. If nobody borrows it, there's no expansion of the money. When you do what you call bonding, which is borrowing, all you're doing is creating new money as a loan. Somebody's going to have to pay it back at some point. On the second page is how the money plan works that I'm asking you to do, and then I'll show you one more item. Minnesota law regulates state chartered banks that I'm talking about. You're the man or the woman that controls the rules and regulations under which state chartered banks operate, from the director to the how many extensions they can have, how many branches they can have. You control it all. I'd like you to tell the state chartered banks that the legislature hereby states that state chartered banks will create checkbook money for all approved road and bridge projects in the state of Minnesota. If Hennepin County, if Dakota County, if anybody wants it, they approve a road and bridge project or maintenance thereof, then that money will be created on the spot with the approval of that road or bridge, no matter how many there are, because you're not going to be able to do every project overnight, no matter how much money you have. You have to have staging and knowledge and information about that. So the money plan just goes through that one thing and tells them, you state chartered bank, the hundreds of you, will create the money, and you won't have to have any reserves. There'll be nothing in the way to stand it. And it's, well, who are you to tell us? I said, we're the legislature. That's what we do. Look at the thousands of rules and requirements, and you'll do that. So I have the bill attached to this. We've done a little bit of this before. It's ready to go. You don't need the revisor. You can do it if you want. It's just a two-page money plan, piece of proposed legislation that says exactly how the plan will work. And if one of you, if one dedicated, committed patriot, it only takes one, drops this in the hopper, it'll move it along, because that's what we're waiting for. We're waiting for Hippity Hop to go there and drop it in, and then we'll move it along. People love the money plan. Nobody that I've spoken with, whether it's the guys of the Minnesota Trucking Association, they love it. You know, if you take off the axle tax and the fuel tax, imagine how much money that's going to mean for industry and labor, and they can pay all the health care and medical care and labor costs that they need. Imagine what it's going to do for all of us, the economy, people not paying a fuel tax. They put that money right in their pocket. They don't have to do a thing. You don't have to work for it. You don't have to wake up in the morning and you save that money by not having to pay the fuel tax. So take a look at the money plan really hard. If you want, I'll bring in my colleagues. One of them is on his deathbed, but we'll drag him in anyway. And he's so committed and dedicated to this, Byron Dale, he'll come in off his deathbed and speak to you about it. This is the most important economic piece of legislation in history. And I'd like you to give it a little more attention than it's been getting in the past. Anything we do to help you with it, we're on board with you all the way.
Thank you, Mr. Davison. We have a question from a member of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative
Davis. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to commend you on your vigor, and I'll certainly look through this. I just wanted to say, if we think for 1 second as a legislator or anybody that if we found a different funding source, I don't think gas tax would go away. We would find a way to still spend in that money, still tax and spend. So I think your plan seems like could be a good idea, and I just appreciate your bringing it forward. I'll certainly take a look at it. Personally would like to talk to you more about it in the future. So thanks so much.
Some people say that, that if you do this, this is going to happen, And I say, well, you need one of those turbines, because if you're going to be a fortune teller or predict the future of what's going to happen or predict negative behavior on the part of people, well, then you need to get a fortune teller's turbine. I've heard people say that once the legislature puts a tax on something, they just can't. But this thing will be so great for everybody, and everybody will love it. So give it a look. Don't be negative about it, because if it wouldn't work, I wouldn't bring it here.
Thank you very much, Mr. Davis.
I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Davis.
By the way, I'd just like to make one comment. I don't have a vehicle, and my colleague, George Holter, was kind enough to drive me up here today. And George, he understands economics and money, because he owns the Richfield Bus Company, which is housed in Bloomington for the last 50 years. I mean, a lot of people that have started and owned a family business for 50 years that's still in operation? So just a kudo to you all, so who George Holter is, a true patriot and a good taxpaying citizen for decades in Minnesota. Thanks again.
Thank you, Mr. Davis.
You'll have a good trip back.
Thank you, Mr. Holter. Yes, thank you. So, Mrs. Jody Slick, I believe, here. Thank you for your patience and for your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I have to say this has been fascinating. I love transportation. The first business.
Oh, can you set your name for the record,
sorry,
please?
Jody Slick.
Yeah.
The first business I started when I was 16 was Amelia Earhead's Plane Wash and Wax. And I actually was a Sea Scout learning to sail tall ships out on the harbor here. And I actually have had my engineer train license. But there are a few things that I'm actually even more passionate about than transportation, and some of that is community. The first job that I actually had as an adult was as a community organizer with the Homeless Organizing Project under Steve O'Neill. And I'm here today to talk to you a little bit about the Twin Ports Interchange project, and give you a little bit of information about the impacts that project will have. It's an interesting project because it is so large. I think at one of the Twin Ports interchange meetings, they actually said the interchange represents 1.6% of all bridge services in the state of Minnesota. You heard earlier as they talked about the scale of the project being 28 bridges, all of which have some sort of load restriction on them at this point. The organization that I run is Equilibrium 3, which is a community-based development organization in the Lincoln Park neighborhood of Duluth. And Lincoln Park actually goes from the Point of Rocks, so right before you get to downtown, to the ore docks, from Skyline Parkway down to the shoreline, and actually also includes the port. And so we recognize the importance of this project on moving freight and transportation, materials from the port. But the Lincoln Park neighborhood is a neighborhood that has 6,500 individuals and is a neighborhood that has been vastly impacted previously by transportation projects. Had an opportunity a few years ago to meet with Secretary Fox, and as we were standing at the deck at the Duluth Entertainment and Convention Center, you can stand there and you can look to the east and you can see how a transportation project done well can be transformational. The transportation project that created the tunnels, created the Lake Walk, revitalized Canal Park, it was a transportation project that is now kind of the foundation for what has become the identity of Duluth. But at the same point when we're standing there at the deck, we could actually turn to the west and say that a transportation project not done well can be transformational. Lincoln Park, the neighborhood that I speak of, at one point, for most of history, it was actually known as West End because it was the west end of downtown. And then when we built I-35, what ended up happening is we ended up pipelining all of that traffic right past the neighborhood. And I'm very happy to say that after 40 years of severe decline, the Lincoln Park neighborhood is actively being revitalized. You may have heard of the Lincoln Park Craft District. It's actually gotten even some national attention. And just as we are at a really key point in the revitalization of this neighborhood, we're going to be now surrounded by the Twin Ports Interchange or Can of Worms project. It's progress that we need, it's infrastructure that we need to address, but I'm here to ask you today to help us make that project as beneficial to the neighborhood and the residents as possible. Lincoln Park, as a low-income neighborhood, has some real startling characteristics. In fact, residents in Lincoln Park die on average 14 years earlier than other zip codes in this community. 20% of our residents' households do not have access to a vehicle, and yet we have bear the burden of this transportation infrastructure. We also have 20% of our residents that are actually disabled. And so I think we've learned a lot as a community and as a society in the last 40 years about things like environmental and social justice, about how we can support small businesses and the impact of our infrastructure projects. And I hope that with the Twin Ports Interchange project, we can kind of rewrite that really negative narrative that often happens to neighborhoods when large infrastructure projects are put in place. And a couple of ways that we can do that is to find the funding that we need to do this project. We recognize economic impact of getting this done and getting it done right. We are at a point, again, kind of a delicate point in our revitalization, but we recognize that even though we're going to be surrounded by construction for 3 to 4 years, it's a necessary evil. And as a neighborhood, we want to emerge from this construction project kind of like a butterfly out of its chrysalis. Getting to a point in which we need to eliminate things like the 53 that comes in to the interchange and maybe delay that for subsequent timing means that we're not talking about a neighborhood that's going to bear the brunt of this project for 3 or 4 years. It, you know, might be extended if you even get that portion of the project done. My colleague, Shannon Lang, who is here, who runs the Main Street Lincoln Park program, often says, you know, we know it's going to be hard, but we'd rather have the Band-Aid ripped off. And so if there's any way, especially where we are with the state's economy right now, of finding the funds to do the project right on behalf of the port, on behalf of the neighborhood, now is the time. It's been stated here earlier, transportation projects don't go away, they just get more expensive. And if we start this project and we're unable to do the full thing, and then we get into an economic downturn, others, that's not only difficult then for the state to make their investment, subsequent investment into the infrastructure, but think of all those small businesses that have gambled on this neighborhood and that are helping us revitalize this neighborhood. To have gambled, to have come into our neighborhood, to have developed businesses in our neighborhood, have faced the construction, and then potentially have to face a prolonged construction period and or economic downturn. It's our opportunity to do things right, environmentally, socially, and economically. And I did hear, as a closing statement, that you guys maybe rode a bus. And if so, I have to tell you, the best food in Duluth on your way back is in Lincoln Park, from the Duluth Grill to OMC to Corktown. And as long as you're on a bus, I'm just saying, there's a few craft brews and cideries there too. So I'd welcome you to come into our neighborhood and learn more. And we are available at any time to kind of help you understand a little bit more of the opportunities and challenges that this project presents. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. Slick? I appreciate your patience and hanging in there with us. Last but not least is Mel Heinrich.
I'm Mel Heinrich from Duluth here. I'm just a same old taxpayer and a truck driver, and I've noticed over the years from the 60s all the way up to now, there's a lot of areas that are heavily traveled by trucks hauling grain and that stuff. And I look at several of them. 371 north of Brainerd is very well congested. If you look at Highway 53 going up to I Falls, is very well congested. You look at Highway 61 out of Duluth or Two Harbors, is very well congested. Everything I've said is reference to we're not planning for the future for the roads of the city or the state or even the city. There should be more four-lane highways expanded over all these years that's going on. We pay enough truck fees, license, whatever it is, and nothing's being done. You know, and it should be tackled. In Duluth here, on 26th Avenue East over here, going up to Highway 61, that is so bottlenecked with traffic during the daytime, it's unreal, you know. And they had citizen input, I think it was back in the 90s, and I went to check in on that, and nothing was done from it. So something needs to be done to stop these bottlenecks and get the traffic or the accidents coming down, you know. And the other thing too is that I went to the meeting over here for the can of worms, and I asked him about the funding and stuff like that, and he started talking about the possibility of hazmat material in that area. And I says, can't you get it from the great big the golden nest egg, you know, from the lottery business? He says, no, they can't do it because it's a separate fund. I said, there's something wrong with here. It's still the same problem. It's taking care of hazmat. You know, there's something wrong with it. You guys have to change the thought on the hazmat for these highway programs. If it's getting to be hazmat, they should be taking all that doggone golden nest egg. You know what I mean? There's no reason for that stuff. You know, it's just common sense. You know, that's the reason why when the lottery was put forward, it was for that. And found out later on that it wasn't going for that part of it. It was being siphoned out. You know, any person who would say, if I picked your pocket, you know, all the time, you would say, where's that money at? And that's the same thing here on the hazmat business. You know, if there's a highway project and needs it, it should be taken out of there, and it shouldn't be taken out of the actual highway funds to take care of it. And that's a simple thing, and thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Heinrich. Any other questions? Excellent. Well, that concludes our public testimony. As is our tradition, we'll have some very brief closing comments from Mr. Torkelson and myself, and then we will head back to St. Paul.
Thank you and good night.
You know, Representative Torkelson was a disc jockey before he was, no, joking. So members, thank you, and thanks to the public. I did want to just mention, you know, we had one of the testifiers, I don't believe is here anymore, made a stereotypical comment about a group of people. I think on both sides of the aisle, we would reject those kinds of comments, particularly in a public forum. So I did want to acknowledge that and mention that is inappropriate for this type of forum. And I wanted to thank, again, we don't have a lot of people left, but to Representative Murphy, Representative Olson, I appreciate your involvement and really your strong advocacy of NLX in particular, I think came through loud and clear today. And I hope that this is something, again, I think the stars have aligned this year, I think, for significant forward movement on this project. And I think we got a good sense from the community about how important it is. So I wanted to thank both of you and thank you for staying this late hour with us. Members, we may have one more hearing in St. Paul in January, informational hearing, a couple of issues that have emerged, you know, that are important. I'll be talking to Representative Torkelson and my side of the aisle about those issues and whether we should do them prior to the session or in the course of the session. I would just say that, again, to members, again, both sides, the odd-numbered or the even-numbered year moves quickly. And what we'd like to do is hear as many bills as possible, as early as possible. There will be early deadlines. So my guess is that there will be a pre-filing period, usually that ends a few days before February 11th. I don't have the dates of that period yet, but we just encourage you, while we're all together and we have some time in December and January, get those bills in. Get them jacketed, and I would, you know, like to hear as many as possible in the first few weeks of session. So, but we may have a couple of hearings, or at least one hearing in January, and then I would anticipate going back to our regular schedule in February. But no more field hearings, although we do have a couple of tours that, you know, that would just last a few hours that are in the works, one in northern suburbs and one to tour townships, southern suburbs in Shakopee. This was an idea that Representative Torkelson and I had heard from the townships when we met with them in St. Cloud. So we have a few more things to do before the regular session, but no more day-long hearings at this point are planned. So with that, members, thank you very much. We are adjourned.